Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Robert Lathrop. Today is May 17, 2004. It's approximately 10:41 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Lathrop is in Sutherland, Oregon. Sir, why don't we begin with where you were born and when you were born, and a little bit about your childhood.
Okay. I was born in Walla Walla, Washington on June 8th, 1942, which happens to be the day of the Battle of Coral Sea, I think.
Yes, sir.
And I have a photographic memory, and I started documenting things before I could talk. Mm-hmm. And in World War II, we didn't have anything. My dad worked, worked as a Caterpillar parts man. He couldn't go to war because he was the last person there in his business. And we couldn't get gas, so I remember the war. I can remember the war. We lived between a B-24 base and a 15,000-bed Army hospital, so I saw the worst effects of the war.
Now, where was this again?
Walla Walla, Washington.
Okay.
Southeastern Washington. We had a big B-24 base on one end of town, and the bombers came over our house at about, some 80 feet, 100 feet. And then the other end, we had a 15,000-bed Army hospital with the worst casualties you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so before I was 2 years old or 3 years old, and up to when I was about five, I saw the worst of World War II. And the first thing that I could have a perfect image of, and I could draw it, was it turns out to have been in August 1944, when I was 2 years and 2 months old.
Mm-hmm.
We went out, and there was this massive fire, and we were parked in an old pickup with a cracked window, and my mother was there with her red hair, and in front of us was a 37 Chevy, and behind us was a 1939 or 40 Chrysler, and off looking toward the town was a fire as far as I could go. He said, listen, you could smell. I have a perfect image of that with odors and everything, and what I see was a B-24 burning 11 people to death. And when I have an image so bright, it means the anxiety was so high. And
right. You said it was an image. The B-24 had crashed, and 11 people were burning.
11 people were burning to death in the B-24.
Okay.
Interestingly, after 40 years later, I went back to the same spot without ever having been there with my dad, and I didn't know how I did that. It was like an imprint in my body.
Right.
Anyway. So I saw the worst effects of World War II. I grew up in a little town called Dayton, and I grew up sort of like Tom Sawyer. We had an old farmhouse when I first lived there. It was so cold in the wintertime that I iced up the windows. And I grew up outdoors, running up and down creeks and hiking in the mountains and bicycling out in the country. And by 1950, things got better. And my dad had a nice business. He was a John Deere dealer. So we were quite well to do.
Okay.
And I lived at the edge of town, but I spent all my time in the mountains and the hills along the creeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to high school at Dayton High School.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have a sister, and my mother lost a baby.
Okay.
So my sister, her husband's a Vietnam veteran, and he's just starting to open up, too,
mm-hmm.
and they live in Olympia.
Okay.
She was 3 years behind me.
Okay.
And in 1951, we moved to a new house. So I had a good life from then until I left home.
Okay.
But I was strictly an outdoor person. I was active in high school sports.
Mm-hmm.
And high school sports and plays and clubs and things. It was a small high school, 300 students.
Before we go there, sir, tell me a little bit about your parents. What was your mother like?
My mother grew up in a little town called Touche, Washington. Her dad was a grocer. But when she grew up in the 30s, the 20s and 30s, they didn't have anything. And she slept on the front porch of a one-bedroom house with her brother. And her dad opened a grocery in 1931. She was probably 14. And they eked out an existence there in that house. And they had an outhouse, an indoor toilet. And she was... she was 5'4" and slim, with real long, quite pretty when she was young, and she was athletic in high school too.
Mm-hmm.
And she was athletic all her life. She bowled and golfed, and in Dayton she was active in. They did P people, without TV, people had clubs they'd go to during the day, and she golfed. And but she was a homemaker. She didn't work. She worked for the welfare department in Washington until my dad and her got married a year before, a little over a year before I was born. And she basically lived that way. My folks moved to Walla Walla when I was in college, and that's where she is now. She's 85, and she survived a heart attack, and her mother was alive till she was 104, and she's got two aunts alive that are 109 and 98.
So. Wow, this bodes well for you then, sir.
I hope so. And anyway, she's still active. She still works. She works 2 days a week at the senior center, and she plays the piano for a violinist, and she's a writer, just local in papers, and she writes poetry also. But she belongs to a book club and still drives. And but she's not able to do things. So I go back and forth taking care of the house she lives in. She has a big two-bedroom bungalow house, a Craftsman, I think they call it. And right in the old wealthy neighborhood of Walla Walla, the houses around her have maid's quarters and three stories and all that. And her house was built for the daughter of one of these houses, so it's a smaller house, but it's in a quite nice neighborhood. And that's, well, I grew up in a quite nice neighborhood, too, with sidewalks and typical 50s perfect life, you know.
Right, right. Well, tell me about your father. What was he like?
Well, my father grew up. His father also came from Touche, and my grandfather was a school teacher, and then so my grandfather was a school teacher when my dad was born, but he lost his job when he didn't have enough education. He owned an electric shop. My dad was raised in Walla Walla in what would today be called poverty, but then probably was called the middle class. They had a small two-bedroom house, and he had a brother and a sister, half-sister. One's still alive. His brother is a doctor of physics, but he's now in a care home. And Dad grew up, he was a hard worker, but he never stuck with things. He was very, very talented, played the violin and the symphony and things like that as a child, but he didn't want to do things what other people did, so it took him 5 years to get through high school. Then that was the middle of Depression, and he was almost like the Joads that came across and went to California. He went down to pick fruit and eked out an existence, and he got a job with a tractor company in Walla Walla, and he moved around from Walla Walla to Pendleton to Athena and got married, and during the war, he was a parts man in Walla Walla, and he was the last worker there. He alternately got drafted, and then they gave away the draft, took away the draft, so he didn't have to go to the war. His brother did, but we moved to Dayton in 1946. I can remember driving up there through Waitsburg and that little town and our old farmhouse. So he was only 31, he took over management of the John Deere dealership in Dayton, which was then, Columbia County was the richest county of the state of Washington. And so when he sold John Deere and Katz, he made a lot of money. And so my dad was quite well respected as a salesman. He was honest. He was real honest. And John Deere was a good company to work for because they carried farmers through the bad years. So we did quite well through high school, but it was up and down in farming. Until I got in high school, my dad was an athlete himself. He played basketball and played it. We had a city softball league, and he played golf. He was an outdoor person.
Did he influence you with being outdoors and that? I did
it on my own. I had no other interests. He didn't do things with me. The things he did, I was too young to do. He did on his own. And I developed the same things, but then I grew up in a place where everybody did that. Hunting and fishing were part of life there. And I hiked in the Wallowas. I hiked in the Wallowas when I was 11 years old and hunted deer and birds and stuff when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of grew up, as I say, like Tom Sawyer, making rafts and floating down creeks and
mm-hmm.
hiking in the mountains. And as kids, we grew up with all the kids doing things together in the evening. And so I grew up in a town where there were true neighborhoods where ladies got together and had tea during the week, and where the kids got together and played games until dark, and
mm-hmm.
we dated each other's sisters and ran around with each other's brothers, and
mm-hmm.
this went throughout the town. And very close, it was a very close town in some ways, but there was no middle class. We were a wealthy town because of the farmers, but the people that didn't have money didn't have much, so
mm-hmm.
we had no middle class. And we would have been part of an upper middle class, which included very few people.
Right.
You know? Since we weren't landowners, we were sort of on the outside, and weren't invited to the big parties with the wheat farmers and stuff. And
mm-hmm.
the people my folks had to do with were other business owners and some of the farmers they were friends with. And my mother, I guess she got what would today, she lost a baby, and I guess she got what would be called now postpartum depression.
Right.
And so we had a hard time from then on, because my mother would go away. She had like a nervous breakdown, and so I'd have to go live with friends for a while, and this sort of went off and on for until
mm-hmm.
I graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
Can
you tell me, sir, what kind of jobs you had? Did you work when you were young?
I started working when I was 14 in an orchard changing sprinkler pipe.
Okay.
I mean, that's a full-time job. I mowed lawns before that. We were expected to work.
Mm-hmm.
And when I sat down the first time I got a job, and I think most kids were told this, my dad says, nobody gives a damn what you do. They look at what you do as a reflection of me. And this is, if you don't do good, it reflects on me, not you. So you better do good or you know what's going to happen.
Right.
And so I got a work ethic young, and the people in my class all got that.
Mm-hmm.
And in our lives today, we've pulled out and started over with nothing again and again. So we got that work ethic. And I started working in an orchard by putting the tops off of trees so they'd sprout, changing sprinkler pipe. Then I started driving a tractor and pulling a sprayer. And when I got to be 17, I went to work for Green Giant Company, and I drove swather, cutting peas at nights, and I worked right along the dregs of the world. That gave you a little humility. Here, the local boys drove the tractors. We had four swathers, two cats, and two loaders, and there were about six of us out there.
So, excuse me, a swather, S-W-A-T-H-E-R?
Yeah, it cuts... It cuts crops and windrows, and they were old, beat-up things made
mm-hmm.
before World War II, and we cut on hills and worked dikes, but we worked right alongside Mexicans from Mexico, and we made the same amount of money, and
right.
the white men, I worked alongside Jesse James' great-grandson,
huh.
And so I got to see a side of life of World War II veterans
mm-hmm.
would talk in our presence of things.
Mm-hmm.
It was like we lived in a separate world. They would talk about their lives as though we weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys would cut your throat for a nickel, but they separated us out. You know, as long as we didn't cross into their world, they didn't cross into ours. It was a tough way to grow up, because we were out there with pretty rough people, and we worked 12 hours, but we rode both ways in our own time. So it was a 14-hour day, making the $1.05 an hour.
Mm.
I slept during the day in 100-degree heat, and they worked in the cold nights. And
mm-hmm.
okay, when I was a freshman in college, I went to work and put myself through college. First, I had a Navy scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the Navy program. And then I also had a summer job working for Green Giant Company as a foreman of their field sampling crew. I had like 13 employees.
Right.
And I made enough to go to college, have my, get what clothes I had, and have a sports car through college doing that.
Okay.
And I also worked for the Forest Service and a little bit logging.
Mm-hmm.
And during spring breaks, I'd pick up jobs. Basically, I put myself through college with the help of the Navy, and my grandmother helped me once.
Right.
But I got through college on probably $7,000 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
By keeping my grades up, I could get my out-of-state tuition back. I went
right.
to the University of Idaho.
Well, now, speaking of grades, tell me about how you were as a student, starting from a young boy all the way up.
Well, I guess I would today be called a hyper, what do they call it, attention deficit disorder.
Yes, sir.
I had a lot of nervous energy. And I know now that I hit a plateau in the first grade. I actually went to a private kindergarten, and in the first grade I couldn't do well, but kids hit plateaus, and about the middle of the first grade I became a good student, a B plus student,
mm-hmm.
by not doing anything. I could do it without just osmosis, and when that happened, I stayed that way right up until it got too hard.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't study at all, and I didn't much study in high school either, so my grades went down in high school. I graduated with a B-minus average out of high school without doing much study. I took
mm-hmm.
fairly hard courses. I didn't get particularly good grades, but on certain things, I did real well.
What were your favorite subjects? What did you enjoy?
History, definitely history. When I was graduated from the eighth grade, the Hutters of American Revolution came in
mm-hmm.
and gave a test on American history. And I guess they gave it to all sixth, seventh, and eighth graders. Oh, I guess it was through sophomore year, and I got the best score because we didn't have TV. We had a Carnegie Library. And I used to take home books in four and five at a time. So by the time I was in the eighth grade, I knew the history of lots of things. And then we took history every year from the third grade to a senior in
mm-hmm.
high school.
Mm-hmm.
So history would be my most interested course. But writing and English came easy to me, and I probably did better there. Well, possibly because of the reading, I picked up vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, as degrading now, I could spell anything right. Now it seems to be going away. But I was sort of a loner. I liked the outdoors. I had friends like myself, and all my friends were readers.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was a reader, and my friends' fathers were readers. So
mm-hmm.
books in an early age were a big part of my life.
Okay.
And I started collecting them at an early age, some of which I still have.
Hmm. Okay. Tell me about your sports. You mentioned that you did participate.
Okay. I played football. Well, I started by boxing when I was like in junior high, but they outlawed it when I was a freshman, and I was too small. You had to be a certain minimum weight
right.
before you could box at all, and I was too small, and they outlawed it, so I played football around a track team, and of course, as a freshman, I didn't get a letter until I was a sophomore, and I got it in track. And as far as current times, I wasn't very fast. I ran as a senior, and we had we didn't have any divisions in track, so a school like Vide would run against a school with 2,000 students, and we did fairly well against them. We had a group of kids that grew up together, so we were number two in the state in football my senior year and undefeated and rated my junior year. And we were playing in a league of 300 to 800, and we only had 304 students. So
wow.
We were good in sports. The sport I could have been good in, basketball, I didn't turn out with till I was a senior, and I was the 11th man on the team. But I was active in sports other than that, in that I was in outdoor sports because I hunted and fished. Matter of fact, my whole life was outdoors, bicycling, sport,
right.
You name it. We had football. We had little football games, you know, and basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So basically my life was outdoors and sports from the time I toddled across the street into the forest when I was 2 years old in Walla Walla. And it's been that way always. But in a sense, either I was that way naturally and my personality was that way or affected my personality because I was never comfortable around groups of people. I tended to push, say things and do things that would distance myself, never really being comfortable as an in part of a group.
Okay.
I'm an independent. I was comfortable as a fighter pilot.
Okay. So, was it expected that you would go to college, or did...
It was expected by my father. It was not expected by me. I liked that town. I liked that little town. And I still like it. I always wanted to go back. But the reality is, I did go back once, and I saw that I had no future. I quit college and went back and worked for... And I could see that if I had went to work for my father, I'd do okay, but I never could work for him.
Right.
He was too critical. And so I went on. It was expected by my father I would go to college. And
What year did you graduate high school? I'm sorry for interrupting.
1960.
1960, okay.
1960, and it was expected I'd go to college. I also had an uncle, which is rare, who went to college. He was a Ph.D. in physics. And he still is a Ph.D. in physics. He had graduated from Rice Institute, and he worked first just for a while for Boeing, but then he worked in Wisconsin at the Institute of Paper Research and Chemistry. Then he was a professor at University of Western Illinois in McComb until he retired. So we did have education in our family, but nobody else. When I went to school, you know, it was suggested that I take business and get out of state and everything. And I just didn't feel comfortable going into the business world because I would have to. I saw what my dad had to do in business. What, you know, you got to give to everybody and. I just was too independent to do that, so I wanted a farm or ranch, but I didn't have a relative that had one. I couldn't afford to buy one, and that was why people went to forestry school when I went. They were farmers and small town kids that had no place of their own, and so I decided I'd become a forester so I could work outside as a forester or a surveyor, and that's why I went to forestry school for the independence. But it was a good education because it was a scientific education.
Right.
And it's exactly the education you need to be an intelligence officer. And it allowed me to do things subsequently in my life. That education with all the statistics and everything, because forestry, what you have is not what you worry about. What you think about is the past and the future. And you have to determine the past and the future by analysis of what you've got now. That's exactly what you do in intelligence work. And so my forestry education fit right in with the Marine Corps.
Right.
You know.
So. Let me ask you a couple questions before we move into college life. What did you think of the Korean War?
I remember being scared. And the reason I was scared was because I saw what I saw in World War II.
Right.
You know, and I was hearing it on the radio and seeing it in the newspaper. We didn't have television. But I was just afraid that it was the same thing was going to happen that happened in World War II, that there was going to be plane crashes and soldiers in the hospital. And,
now, did you get to see the soldiers in the hospital?
I mean, I saw it by the hundreds, thousands. The hospital was where the VA hospital is now, which is an old cavalry fort. And they had the wards lined up in barracks buildings, and the whole end opened up. So when it was warm weather, they opened the whole end of that building up, and you could look down the wards, and they were all strung up, the men in white.
Right.
And they had a big fence around it with guard dogs and soldiers in Cebu at the base. It was terrifying to go by there. I remember being scared to death, you know.
So you could actually walk by there and look down in the water.
We drove by, but it was on the old highway to Tushi, south of Walla Walla, and we drove by. That hospital was open until, well, I must have been 6 or 7 years old. Mm-hmm. So I saw it a lot of times. And then the patients would be out. They were all swathed in white. It was an Asiatic Pacific hospital.
Right.
And then those men came to our homes. Not my home, but they came to homes around the area. They married people in the town. And so I saw casualties up close.
Hmm.
And when we went by there, it was scary. And I can remember as a child walking out of movies frightened when there were hospital scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And when there was fire, big fires.
Yes.
I was always terrified of fire after that. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
But if the movies had people burning to death in big hospitals, I'd get so scared I'd have to leave the movie.
Wow.
When I was growing up. And so that definitely had effect on me. I don't think you know what you can see. Have you ever seen a casualty ward in a war?
Yes, I have, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know what they're like.
Yes, it's there are many, many individuals with many different injuries.
I mean, these guys were all strung up, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
to a 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old child, this was terribly traumatic to see hundreds and thousands of men strung up and going around in wheelchairs. And I started blocking things out then. I usually have very vivid images, and those images are blurred.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that's the first time I started actually numbing out. And
right.
Later on, I did block things out.
Well, obviously, you were using a defense mechanism as a youth and just trying
to
protect
yourself.
Well,
it was terrifying. You can't, you know, there was no explanation to me. I don't know that I knew World War II was on. I mean, I knew it was later, but at the time I was just a little boy, and I can remember when the men came home from the war and my uncle came home and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty affected. That's why when Korea came, I was afraid. I was afraid of the same things.
Right.
Yeah, you know, see?
Right.
And I was afraid at movies. We had a lot of war movies, and I was afraid at movies, especially
mm-hmm.
the hospital scenes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Korea, you remember being frightened. Do you remember?
I remember being frightened, yeah.
Did you follow the war, the news? You were, what, about, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old?
My memories of the war at that time are tainted by the fact that we studied Korea intensely in college.
Okay.
So I don't I read about it after the war,
mm-hmm.
and there were movies and things, but I don't think I knew too much about it.
Okay.
I do remember some things. I do remember when we had a retreat from the Yalu.
Yes.
Like, I remember when they fired MacArthur because I was in the fifth grade, and he ran for president, and all the kids got to vote, and there were three people running.
Uh-huh.
I think it was Stevenson, MacArthur, and Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
So I do remember a little bit about that.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
That's where Ridgway took over.
Right, exactly. So 1960, you graduate high school, and are you off to college that fall, or did you take some time?
No, I went to college, and I can remember I had a 54 Buick. I bought that from my dad. And so I had a nice car. When I drove off to college, I can remember thinking, I'm leaving one life for another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for all practical purposes, except coming home to work and things,
mm-hmm.
I never did go back home. And that's the way kids were then. They left when they were in high school, and that was it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like today. You know, we didn't have big houses, and we didn't make, even though we were wealthy, didn't have all that much money to take care of a kid who can take care of himself. And,
yes, sir.
And so when the kids left, they had a work ethic, and they just went on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it was. We didn't look back.
Okay. Tell me about your first year there in college. What was that like for you?
Well, I was scared. My teachers told me that if I did in college, I did in high school, I wasn't going to be there.
Okay.
So when I went, I decided I was probably going to flunk out, so I worked hard. My first year in college, I was an honor student and got about a 3 point. I think I got a 2.9 the first semester, 2.9, just less than a 3 point, did a 3.3. I never much dropped below that. I varied from 3.2 to 3.6 all through college.
Okay.
I graduated cum laude.
Okay. How was the University of Idaho? Was it a good experience?
I don't like being around people.
Right.
And I didn't like college. I didn't like the discipline of having to study.
Right.
I didn't like to sit there for hours and hours and hours. And it was. I found college stressful. I still have nightmares about going in and finding out that they're having a test and I'm not prepared.
Okay.
And walking across the stage, and they don't give me a degree because I forgot a course. You know.
Right.
It was hard for me. I was carrying up to 21 credits. I was in the Navy and I was working. I worked in the dormitory, and so I quit for a quarter after my first year because I was going to join the Coast Guard or something. But then when I went back, I went for two quarters to the University of Washington. Then I went back to Idaho and finished.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like it. I never liked it. I went home every 4 weeks just to get away.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The only thing I really liked is I got to fly to college.
Right.
Flew my first jet as a freshman.
But tell me about that. Tell me about, first, your interests in flying, and then, secondly, joining the ROTC there at the University of Idaho.
Okay, well, I grew up right by that airport.
Yes, sir.
After the war, my gosh, my little town, there must have been 40 or 50 fighter pilots and war pilots came back. And we, in that little town, we knew what people did in the war. And so I always, and then there were the movies and the books. I started reading books, and the first books I read are people who not fought before World War II, the Flying Tigers, who flew in China and stopped Japan, and the people I've always looked up to as the heroes in my life, and that's
mm-hmm.
the British Army and Air Force
mm-hmm.
who fought in the Battle of Britain, who stopped Germany alone, you know.
Yes.
And so that's where I got it. I wanted to fly a Spitfire in the Battle of Britain. I still do. And interestingly, when I focused and when I had to really fight something, that's who I focused on. I focused on if those people could do that, those pilots, that I could do whatever I did. And twice I wrote to the Queen of England and said, this is the 50th year, this is the 60th year, and here's what I've done, and thank you for this. You know? And I got immediate thank you letters back. You know,
that's
those
great.
Are the only two people in public that fought at that time. She was an ambulance driver, and he was on a destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's where my first interest in flying came, was from the Flying Tigers of actually, there were pilots of the free world flying in the Battle of Britain.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I can remember as a youth thinking the exact same thing,
mm-hmm.
reading about those Spitfire pilots and mm-hmm. being amazed at what they were doing.
Yeah, well, those of us who grew up after World War II got a whole different history than kids today.
Mm-hmm.
I knew, for example, that the United States didn't win the war. The Russia and England and Poland and everybody was working together.
Right.
And I knew about Montgomery and El Alamein and that we came in and what we did was it was our industrial might that supplied England to keep her going. So right after the war, when I was educated, we got a real good education about recent history.
Mm-hmm.
Recent history from, say, the time of our revolution to the time I lived in, which kids don't get today at all. And we also got a real good education in geography
mm-hmm.
so that we knew where these things were happening, and kids don't get that either.
Yes, sir. Tell me about the first time you flew in a plane.
Oh, I was 4 years old.
Wow. Do you remember it?
Yeah. Well, maybe five. I think it was a four-place Piper Cub. And we flew out of Dayton, and I remember doing it, but I don't have real memory. That I was four. Then I worked with airplanes a little bit, flagging in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Those were biplanes, and I didn't fly those. Okay, the first time I was in an airplane was when I was a freshman in college, and during the spring vacation, I flew in a C-54 down to Corpus Christi, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and I was, what they were doing is people in the Navy program that wanted to fly started getting to fly as a freshman. So I flew down there in that plane, low altitude, bumping around, people sick, and I flew the Corpus Christi in an F-9F-8 out over the Gulf of Mexico. I actually got to fly the plane, and I got to see the Gulf of Mexico and what it looked like from a jet at 18,000-20,000 feet. Mm-hmm. Saw ships sunk by the Germans off World War II. You can see them in the water out there. And it was beautiful flying in the plane, and I wasn't scared at all. I mean, it was exciting, mm-hmm. The pilot was also an ROTC. He was a Marine
okay.
pilot
okay.
from Chicago area, as I recall, and that was the first time I really got. And I could fly the jet. It's fairly simple to fly a jet. The hard part is the thinking that goes with it. And mm-hmm. so I actually flew the jet and flew over the ocean with the aileron rolls and things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the next year I went down again. And I flew an S2F. And then my senior year, the Navy put you through flight training to see if you'd make a good pilot in college.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually had a pilot's license when I got out of college.
Okay. When did you first get interested in joining ROTC at Idaho?
Well, first off, it was mandatory land-grant colleges then.
Okay.
And I started out not knowing anything about it. But when I got there, I spent my first semester in the Air Force, then I switched over to the Navy because I always wanted to fly as a Navy pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And I never regretted going to the Navy program because it was a far different program than the Air Force and Army ROTC. When you went into the Navy program, you were in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
You were a midshipman. And you were a midshipman just like in the academy. The only thing is you were a midshipman in the Navy Reserve and not in the United States Navy at the academy. And you had an appointment from the Navy instead of an appointment from a congressman. So,
right.
I went through that program interested in flying for the Navy and also interested in forestry, so the two went together,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the courses crossed over. So you had to have the math, the physics, the chemistry that you had to have for Navy all got into forestry.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I go back to wanting to be a Navy pilot, clear back to being a kid. I can remember wanting to fly a Corsair, you know, and the plane I always wanted to fly was a Spitfire, but the Corsair came next.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
So I can never remember not wanting to be a pilot.
How was it with the ROTC military discipline in college? Did you deal with that okay?
Yeah, I did. I knew what I was getting into
mm-hmm.
from having read things. The fact that you were expected to do something had been beaten into me with a work ethic and by a long time. So I was expected to excel. The only mistake I made is switching over to the Marine Corps, and I did that so I could get out of college a year earlier because I ended up with the conflicted courses, and I already had to go 5 years to get through forestry. I didn't want to go six. So after my third year, I switched from the Navy program to the Marine program.
Now, why would you call it a mistake?
I don't think I ever felt I was too independent to fit into the gung-ho, too independent and too much of a free thinker to fit into the gung-ho, high-diddle-up the middle stuff. I bought things out. I also could fire a rifle and knew what you could do going high-diddle-diddle-up the middle.
Yes,
and so when I always disagreed with that tactic. Always, even in the war, I disagreed with it because
mm-hmm.
we took a lot of casualties. We didn't need to, but I didn't have that gung ho attitude. But I did recognize the need for a lot of good training,
mm-hmm.
and the training in the Marine Corps was superb, not only for the Marine Corps but for the rest of your life.
Right.
You learn before I ever got out of college, I'd gone to OCS. In addition to the Navy program, I already was a person who would not give up.
Right.
And they beat that into you. It fast. You just don't give up. When they tell you to do something, you don't say, I'm not going to do it. You analyze how you're going to do it. and you make a decision and do it, and it just comes natural. It doesn't fit always into your life later on, but it is a type of training that gives you strength for officers anyway.
Mm-hmm. You went to OCS while you were at Idaho?
Well, you see, in the Navy program, you go through college. You also go in the summer.
Right.
And you go on ships, and because I got in late, I only had to go one summer.
Okay.
And I ended up with a reserve commission because of it, because I dropped the regular and took the reserve.
Mm-hmm.
So I could only go, that summer, instead of going out on a ship or something, they send you through OCS just like you didn't go through ROTC. And they did kick people out of Navy, put them out of the Marine Corps, and kept putting them back in the Navy at OCS.
Mm-hmm.
And we went, it was just like 8 weeks of infantry training.
Mm-hmm.
What
year was this, sir? Was this summer of, what, 64?
Maybe? Summer of 64.
Okay.
And Quantico, Virginia.
Yes.
And it was it was traumatic to me. I knew it was going to be, but it was traumatic anyway.
Right.
First morning, we had a train, went right by the barracks. The main train into Washington probably went 6 feet from our barracks.
And wow.
I woke up, first time that day, everybody was rolling out of bed. It looked like it was coming right down the middle of the squad bay. And they woke us up with firecrackers, and for eight straight weeks, I guess, we were going up and down the hills and firing rifles, and there was no tomorrow.
Right.
And it was in 100-degree heat, and it was... But, you know, you square away real quick there, because you can't fight the system there. The system will eat you up.
Right.
And so they do change you. They do change you real quick. They won't let you give up.
Right.
You know, you don't quit. You do it until you do it.
Tell me about that kind of training. What did you do? What was a typical day like there?
It started at daybreak. And daybreak, I don't know when it started. Never ended.
Right.
Yeah, it started at daybreak. And you got up. You got up and, well, I can't hardly remember. You got up and everything, we marched. We formed up and we marched to breakfast in formation. Then we marched to back, and then we did things during the day, all sorts of things. We fought with bayonets and rifles and marched and ran and climbed hills and hiked. Then we went to classes, and the worst thing you could do is fall asleep in class. You were so tired you couldn't. Some of the classes, were infantry training, and then one day, if you wanted to be a pilot, they took you in there in 100-degree feet, and you took a test to see if you could get in, and you were so tired, it was hard to do the test. But it just was, basically, I went in one day in six, eight weeks, I can't remember which. Anyway, you came out, and it sent like one day, because just like in combat, days end at midnight, and the Marine Corps didn't end at midnight. It went all night. Usually at the end of the, we would get off after dinner at night to come in and clean up. We had to clean up and clean the boots and everything, fix your rifle, and that's when you did that in the evening. And you could go over and get a beer if you had time. There was a little club there, but basically there wasn't time to do anything but keep going for the Marine Corps. There were times when you marched all night and came in, took a shower, got back and walked out and marched to class.
Wow.
And they pushed you to the limit. People who couldn't make the physicals were dropped out.
How did you do physically?
I was okay as far as keeping up with the stamina. What I didn't have was, and it's typical a lot of people, I didn't have the upper body strength a lot of people had, so I couldn't do 100 push-ups or sit-ups. Some people could, and so I could do the stamina part of it, but I'm tall and thin, and that's not the type of, doesn't give you the upper body strength, but I didn't have any trouble. When we, at the end, we had contests. Everybody had to be in something. I was in the running team where we ran 3 miles and pack and rifle. So, and they picked the top seven. So I could keep up with the stamina. They didn't have the upper body strength. A lot of people there were muscle builders and things, swimmers and things like that. And I wasn't. I was an outdoor person. I ran one year in college.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a lot really smaller, maybe, in build than a lot of them. But I didn't have any trouble with the stamina.
Okay. What was discipline like?
Oh, like cutting it with a knife. Discipline in the Marine Corps always was that way.
Mm-hmm.
Even as pilots, where it was different, you didn't push things too far. Discipline there was, I mean, everything was by the numbers. The only time you had off was Saturday afternoon after about the second week until Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go into Washington basically sleep. We were right on the Potomac, and it was hot and humid.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tough. It was worse than going through boot camp, because instead of harassment being as a group, there were harassment toward individuals to try to break in.
Right.
So if they could pick out a weakness, and they tried to pick a weakness out of me, you got a lot more harassment than other people. But
mm-hmm.
in the end, you were pretty much a team that worked together.
What did they try to find in you? What were they trying to... You said they picked a weakness in you?
Oh, I wasn't familiar with the... A lot of guys there were a lot more familiar with the Marines than I wasn't. So
right.
I was a little uncomfortable, and they sensed that. And boy, they really came after me. Not just me.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just me.
Right.
And it went on for, didn't go on for very long, because anything. I mean, they'd pick stuff. What happened is the people like me that originally, they didn't. They left me alone. There were people whose weakness showed up over the time. We had one guy, we had a couple of three, who started out looking great, that ended up probably, if there hadn't been a war on coming, they would have probably not made it.
Right.
But they looked great in the beginning, and that's what that type of training does.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just end there. You go 6 months to basic school, the same thing later, and it's the same thing there.
Right.
The longer you work, the weak sisters tend to show up among the groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I didn't ever fit in with the ground forces, but I did fit in with the aviation forces.
Right.
And
right.
That was generally true in the Marine Corps.
So when you got back to Idaho, you had one more year left.
Yeah.
And you were ready, when you graduated, to go into active service?
When I graduated, I was a second lieutenant. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
And I got orders by mistake to Quantico, Virginia, which is basic infantry training, when I took a reserve commission. I was supposed to go to Pensacola. So I went, I became a trained infantry officer by mistake.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In 1965 when you graduated?
Yeah, I was supposed to go to Pensacola and become a pilot.
Right.
And I didn't. I went to Pensacola, supposedly, to get a physical. I went to Quantico to get a physical to go to Pensacola. But when I got there, it took 2 weeks even to talk to anybody. And finally, when I went in to talk to a colonel,
mm-hmm.
tell him, he said, "Kid, the Marine Corps doesn't make mistakes. Get out." And that was the end of my... I spent 6 months in infantry training.
Wow.
Became a trained infantry officer.
Wow.
Which haunted me from then on. Then I had to reapply for flight school. So I ended up going out of college into 6 straight months of infantry training right at the start of the Vietnam War.
Right. What was that like?
We know we were going to war.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly enough, everybody out of college didn't seem to give a damn. They screwed off and played grab ass. As I say, we worried about the war when we got to it, but we
right.
knew what was going to happen.
Right.
I didn't do very well there because of my personality. I don't feel comfortable being in an innate group, and I wasn't going to say I was gung-ho in the Marine Corps. That wasn't true. I was there for the training. I'm an analytical person.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, I was married with a child by then.
Oh, really?
I got married in college, you know.
Okay.
Illegally, we weren't supposed to be married. But then a lot of us got married anyway.
What do you mean, illegally?
You couldn't be married to a midshipman.
Really?
Yeah, no. For one time, you couldn't be married to a second lieutenant either, but I got married anyway.
Okay.
Anyway, and there were quite a few people showed up at Quantico from the Navy, even the Academy, mm-hmm. immediately put children on their, you know, one and even two children on their records when they were totally commissioned 2 weeks before.
Right.
You know, so, I was married when I got there, but my wife had to stay home. She had a baby then.
Okay.
And so, when I got there, the first day, felt out of place, but I got used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really fit in with the core group, the gung-ho, charge up the hill stuff. And these people were quite immature, too. I had fought forest fires, and I had worked as a foreman out with the toughest people, you know, in the woods and stuff. I had a lot more experience in dealing with people as a manager over difficult people than they had.
Mm-hmm.
They were still this gung-ho, and I just wasn't that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they perceived me as not being worth a damn, but when I had to, they'd assign you billets, I did okay.
Right.
But I didn't do well in basic school. I graduated number two in my class in college, in the bottom 10% of basic school.
Wow.
However, I was a pilot, too.
Right, right.
Okay, pilots weren't considered real Marines by the infantry. As I say, I graduated the bottom of my class of basic school, and 4 months later, number two in my class in flight and pre-flight.
Did you go right down to Pensacola after that 6 months?
Well, I got orders to Pensacola, and I went down and I checked into the Naval Air Station
mm-hmm.
at Pensacola on January 1st. And 1966, and everybody was on leave yet except the three or four of us who had families and lived too far away. There weren't many people who had children.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one out of 20. Anyway, but there were three of us that went from basic school to flight training. There wasn't any class to start.
Huh.
So what they did is put us in the class that was starting, which was all foreign students. So I went through pre-flight with the entire naval air arm of Peru and Ethiopia, about 35 Vietnamese students. And,
oh my gosh!
There was a couple Navy people that were becoming naval aviators after being naval flight officers. So there was only about five Americans.
Oh.
But they were pretty sharp. It was hard, a hard course. I never had anything thrown at me so fast. It was in pre-flight.
Right.
When you are given something one day and have to do it the next, it's hard to learn.
Yes.
And I studied hard. And as I say, I was married then. We had a house, and I knew people in my class from basic school, but I think I was the only Marine pilot. No, there were two Marine pilots. I can't remember. They had also people go through pre-flight to go to become radar intercept operators and Phantoms. So I was with two other Marines and a couple Navy people, and then all these foreign students, some of whom I got to know.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to study hard,
mm-hmm.
harder than college, much harder. And you had to know it cold. For example, even to get in the door, they gave you a test that equaled a couple of years of college math and a year of college physics.
Right.
That's just to walk in the door, okay? And then from then on, they just throw it at you. Aerodynamics and engines, and you had to learn how all these real technical stuff, and you had to pretty much commit it to some sort of image so you could draw it back.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you can study in college, you can study there.
Right.
And the other thing is they have teaching processes that make you learn faster, program texts.
Mm-hmm.
They had it canned, you know, so that you were only focusing on what you needed, not all the extraneous stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I did okay. And we had a survival thing where we went out for 3 days or 4 days and starved. And I was there in the winter time, so...
Mm-hmm.
And when you graduated from then, you went to, everybody went to Softley Field. Mm-hmm. And in Softley Field, you flew the T-34.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody flew that was going to become a pilot. And since I'd already flown planes like it, I aced the course, both academically and the thing. I graduated with, they had a 4-point scale, and I think I had a 3.6.
Okay.
Okay, and then they take out of Softley. That's where it determines what kind of plane you fly.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they cut the top Marines, about the top 4 or 5%. They cut them off and send them to jets. Everybody else goes to helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I did make the cut, and I went to Meridian, Mississippi.
Okay,
and I lived in a house in town. I was there during when James Meredith was shot, and when they killed those people and buried them in a dam.
Yes.
And I was right in the middle of it. We had the Mennonite church across the street, and then the Salvation Army and all that. So it sort of went around me, but that was going on there, and I actually flew over that march in an airplane. But that's where I learned to fly jet.
Okay. Let's stop here for a second. Let me ask you a couple questions about historical events that you witnessed or had a chance to witness. And,
mm-hmm.
and actually, that was when you mentioned Meridian, Mississippi. I assume this is 1966.
Yes.
I thought about that. First of all, the assassination of John Kennedy, 1963.
I was in geology class, and I was in a staunchly Republican region. Boy, and when he was killed, the instructor said, "Is that right?" and started on with the lecture.
Wow. How did you feel about it personally?
I didn't like John Kennedy at all. I was in a staunchly Republican era, the Republican myself. However, I didn't have a chance to do anything because there was no reaction around me.
Right.
I mean, it was sort of like hitting the Mealy thing. It hit us, and was old. When I found out Mealy hit me, and then everything went on, and I didn't have time to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember where I was, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I remember we got out of school, and I went home, and everything was sad, and everything on TV.
Right.
But it didn't hit me as painful.
Okay. Tell me, what was the atmosphere in Meridian, Mississippi like? What do you remember about the marches and the controversy that happened?
I didn't fight the system. I lived right in the community. They didn't have any housing for pilots, so our second lieutenants and the Marines and our ensigns and Lieutenant JGs, we lived out in town right with the problems, you know, and the
mm-hmm.
black neighborhoods and everything. Same way in Pensacola. I knew the situation. I didn't argue with them. We had people killed, pilots killed, both in Texas and Meridian, by walking in the bar just trying to drink, beat up and everything. So I pretty much kept to my own group of people. I did have neighbors, and one neighbor who was a radio announcer, another who was a retired sergeant, died in the war, Mississippians, and people here, and I'll tell you that they're dealings with blacks was basically, you know, they just didn't exist.
Right.
Matter of fact, they didn't exist. I once was running in the field across the street, and I went through the trees, and there was a black neighborhood there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. It was only 200 yards from my house because no black kid ever came through those trees. And everywhere I lived, in Pensacola, there was a big high fence at the end. I looked over it once. There's a black neighborhood. It was separate. Interesting, I went back to reunions, not that way anymore.
Right.
But anyway, everything was separate. Bathrooms, his, hers, and theirs.
Right.
You know, and drinking water, colored and white. And,
mm-hmm.
and Mississippi was, as I said that, while I was there, they shot James Meredith. We flew over that march, you know, tried to see it. It was down the highway just not too far from our base.
Yes.
5 or 10 miles, maybe, and I flew down the highway to watch it. I don't know that I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But then, it wasn't too much. I learned about those people being murdered later.
Mm-hmm.
That was there, too.
Right.
But I'll tell you something. Stuff went on Meridian that just left you cold. It was a motel. It looked like a normal motel out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And lights and everything. You walked in there, there was nobody. There was nobody to serve you. It was just a motel with nobody in it. And you wouldn't get it, but it stayed there. It was a motel with lights and everything. Something was going on. I didn't know what. But you didn't go by, you'd go back again. And certain things weren't discussed, and I didn't know what they were, because they were the other people from the South not discussing them around me.
Did you find out what was happening?
No. Some people would talk, and some people wouldn't. It was not something we talked about. They had their views, and I had no views.
Right.
The blacks I grew up with in my hometown, one made shoes, and one fixed shoes, and one worked for the railroad, and I never thought too much about them being different. And so my first view of blacks was in the South, and they were pretty much separate.
Mm-hmm.
We had blacks and Marines with us,
mm-hmm.
and they pretty much stuck with us, you know.
Yeah. How were they treated by the other Marines?
They were considered, I don't know, not all Marines thought like I did. They weren't all treated good by other Marines. I had two commanding officers,
mm-hmm.
black, but I used to hear some of the Southern boys talk, and they didn't talk too much to people like me.
Mm-hmm.
The people who tended to criticize and look on people like me were people from the Northeast.
Okay.
The one-upmanship. I always travel first class on an airplane. I live. We prepped at so and so. What's your family do? I mean, this stuff, you know.
Right.
How much money is your? I mean, everything was based on some sort of status symbol. They didn't have prep schools where I grew up, and so they could not identify with people from the Northwest, the West in general. And so they tended to, like, put us down.
And I guess they certainly couldn't identify with the folks from the South either.
But the folks from the South have a different status system.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the South, I was a gentleman. I was a military officer.
Right.
In the South, you have a family background, but you also have a job. In the South, the three people that are looked up to at that time were a military officer, a physician, and a preacher.
Mm-hmm.
Those three people had status, where I grew up, landowners and businessmen. And money, where I grew up, was not something that was particularly looked on, because the people with money didn't show it. But the people from the Northeast, money was what they focused on,
mm-hmm.
and because their lifestyle was based totally on income.
Mm-hmm.
And the people from the Midwest were somewhere in between. It's funny, our pilots came largely from the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say three quarters of our pilots came from somewhere in the West. And I think that's because in the West, during World War II and the time we were growing up, that's where all the aviation was. You had
mm-hmm.
Boeing and McDonnell.
Yes.
All over. I saw airplanes from the time I was a little kid. And then from the South, that's where your big infantry people in the Northeast. All those Southerners, boy, the Marine Corps, to them, that was like God. And they were infantry, artillery, and tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And the people from the West that I knew were into aviation, and that's largely into aviation. We had like four pilots from Washington State in Vietnam out of 16.
Hmm.
So I think your upbringing had to do with where you fit in the Marines.
Right. Now, by the time you got to Meridian in 1966, what were your views on what was going on in Southeast Asia?
I knew I was going to go there. I already had seen the films from there.
Right.
I knew what was going to happen, but I figured a war would probably be over by the time I got there. Okay. Hoped anyway. But I did not particularly think about it I didn't particularly think about it because I had enough to do where I was,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty much an unknown. We got intelligence reports, but let's say something happened to me. When I got a naval hospital, I had taken the intelligence course. My first intelligence analysis was of this six-day war, because I got out at the end of April of 1967, so I was put analyzing intelligence reports of the planned war between Israel and the Arab world. And so
right.
That was what I was studying at the time. So I didn't know much about Vietnam. The Arab-Israeli war took my first... My first intelligence analyses came from that war and nothing in Vietnam.
Hmm.
So I knew what was happening in Vietnam. It was a jungle war. But I went to Vietnam before I got there permanently as a pilot, so I knew when I finally did go what it was going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
But I went there as a ferry pilot before I went there on orders.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about your specific training at Meridian. What did you do there?
Well, you start out, just like everything, you start learning to fly the plane. A jet plane doesn't have immediate thrust, and it goes faster than you can think. So you have to learn to think ahead of the plane, and that takes energy, a lot of energy.
Which airplane was this?
It was called the T-2A.
Okay.
Buckeye. They still use a version of that, or they did. But anyway, it was about a 300-knot jet, straight wing with wing tanks. So it was fairly easy to fly. Straight wings don't break away stall. We learned it first to take off and land, and we went from take off and landing to instruments to formation flying. And when you learned to fly four main formation flights, you graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to Pensacola, and you did air-to-air gunnery.
Mm-hmm.
And you hit the boat, you hit the aircraft carrier.
Right.
And a T-2, okay? And that was the basic T-2 training. And we started our briefs at 4 in the morning and ended at 10 at night. And we flew night flying, and we lost points, started losing people there.
This is at Meridian? Or mm-hmm. you went to Meridian to Pensacola?
Right, and from Pensacola to Kingsville.
Okay.
Okay, in Kingsville, you're in a swept wing jet.
Okay.
That was the Cougar jet. Later, the A-4 that I flew in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those times where we went TAD to Pensacola, my wife and I, and I liked that. That was great because we were flying out over the ocean and shooting at the banner and landing on aircraft carrier and everything. It was sort of free because we were getting extra pay and we didn't have our furniture and stuff. That was in transit to somewhere else, so we were sort of living like out of a suitcase and
mm-hmm.
sort of a free time. And the flying was great. Good weather and flying over the ocean. And it was beautiful. I used to watch those T2s taking off at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, one right after the other, six of them taking off and turning mm-hmm. out over the ocean. When I was in pre-flight, and then I was doing it. And I just loved doing that.
Did you consider yourself a natural pilot?
I didn't know. I didn't know until later.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know until later what I did well and what I didn't do well. I wasn't a natural pilot in some ways, in that it took me a while to break in. First off, you learn to fly by the numbers. Then there's a period when you don't fly, and you do good then, but then there's a transition period where you start flying by feel, where you're not so good. Then you get to flying better, and the more you fly, the more you get.
Mm-hmm.
The people, you're not a bad pilot for the fact that you're in the top 5% to start with, but I would say that I was an average jet pilot. But the average jet pilot is what you want to be. You don't want to be the top dog. The top and the bottom are the ones that get killed.
Hmm.
Yeah. For example, I used to take flak because in combat I didn't make the standard runs on napalm and bombing. I stayed high and came in. Why put yourself in ground fire all the time?
Mm-hmm.
I also gave myself more fuel. You got to remember, when I was in flight training, I punched out of a plane, went into a fireball and didn't get a shoot. I did that before I went to the war.
Oh, what? Describe that incident. What happened? When was this?
This was in Kingsville on March 19th, 1967.
Okay.
I was just about done, and I was going out on a bombing hop, my first bombing hop, and I was number two of a six-plane flight. Number one went down, and I went out, and I took the lead, and I had an instructor with me because it was my first flight, and I pushed the throttle forward, and the plane lifts off, and those old F-9 just staggered in the air. And I got to about 400 feet, and I heard this loud metallic clunk, and I looked up, and I was looking at the ground attacking. And the plane was pitching over, and I tried to pull a stick back, and then I swept up and ejected. And then everything went into slow motion, and I saw the seat above me, and then I rolled slowly over. And I saw the plane go into the ground in this big wall of fire. And then I looked up, and I didn't have a chute, and I looked down, and I went into the fireball. And then I don't remember anything for a long time. I woke up, I was already up on my knees, and I was right in the middle of a fireball. I couldn't see, and I was being burned badly, and something dark showed up, and I ran. And that turned out to be an avenue in the fire, about 5 feet wide, maybe a wind gust, but the flames would roll out and just cut me like a knife. Mm. And when I ran out, my chute must have opened, because the faster I ran, the closer the fire. Finally, I turned around and swapped my chute out, you know. There was only about 6 feet of the shrouds left, and I pulled that off. I knew we were well trained. I knew I was in shock.
Right.
Okay. The watch, my watch had burned through my arm. I could see that. And I could see the skin hanging down. And I was bleeding. I got hit by a part of the explosion. I walked over to the other pilot, and instinctively knew not to touch him. He had hit in his seat. Then the chute opened to pull him out, and he was broken in the middle. And you don't touch someone with a hurt back.
Right.
The helicopter came in then, and they went for him, and they dumped me off in front of the tower. They couldn't see the injuries, and nobody came to get me. So finally I went, and somebody took me up to the dispensary there at the air station there at Kingsville, and all of a sudden I said, you know, I want a shot of morphine. And they had to cut my stuff. I still had my G-suit. No, I didn't have my G-suit. I guess I'd taken it out. But what happened is the nylon stuff melted through my flight suit. So I was burned on my legs, arms, face. My oxygen mask had melted into my face. But I had it on, so I was breathing oxygen. I was burned over 30% of my body. And then I started to stiffen up. Mm-hmm. And they put me in an ambulance. And I can remember that ambulance ride. Because people would look and point. You know what they were doing? They were laughing.
Laughing?
Yeah, why would they do that? Well, of course, it was on the radio. Yeah, the people were laughing in the car.
As you went.
Yeah, they were laughing and smiling when they'd point to me, you know, because it was on the radio. I never understood that.
In the back of the ambulance?
I was in the back of the ambulance. They were in cars going by.
But could they see you?
Yeah, it was a big open ambulance, about 68 Pontiac, the whole side was glass.
Okay.
But, you know, maybe it's nervous. I don't know. I can remember that because I didn't know if I was going to live or not.
Right.
The pilots just got burned and died. They both died when I was in the hospital. And I didn't want to go to San Antonio, and they kept me at Corpus Christi. The other two died, and I didn't. We had about the same amount of burns.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to lay in the hospital with Vietnam casualties there. Same type of hospital I saw as a kid.
Wow.
Walla Walla. Exactly the same. Same type of casualties, too.
Was that hard for you?
I didn't think about the time, but I started blocking things out then.
Okay.
I can remember when I could walk. I had to walk the x-ray. They had wards there of casualties.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't move. They were just lumps of that. And I started blocking that out.
Okay.
I can see it now. I don't see it. You know, I look, and there's just white.
Right.
You know, and there's nothing there. And that's not good.
Well, I guess that tells you there's something.
Well, what happened is I came out of the hospital with one slight change. I had claustrophobia in places that I didn't have it before, and I was hurt worse than they knew. I hit the ground without a chute. They didn't find out till 1990. I had a broken neck, fractures all through my back.
Oh, my gosh.
And I got out and went right back in the cockpit with that. And in Vietnam, I couldn't turn to look to the left. And and I was real stiff. But I, what it really took is, what it really took is energy. Your body takes energy to fight those things, and I wasn't as strong as I was before.
So you went 23 years with a broken neck and back?
Yeah. Wow. Well, I knew I had fractures in the middle of my back, and I knew I had pain in my neck, and the neck pain goes down your arms. I knew I had pain there, but they didn't find it till 1990.
Wow.
So I went into combat that way, and so... Actually, because I had orders from flight training to Vietnam, I got out of the hospital 6 weeks later. I was in a replacement, or 8 weeks later, I was in a replacement squadron for Vietnam, and they put me in a ferry squadron. So I only got 40 hours in the States in a two-seat plane, and I was heading for Vietnam over the ocean.
That's incredible.
I wasn't. I was more afraid flying over the ocean on a single-engine plane than I ever was in combat.
Now,
so I had a hell of a lot of stress. I went to Vietnam with PTSD. I know that now.
Yeah. This crash, was it ruled a mechanical failure?
Well, what happened is it was mechanical failure, and I was pretty analytical, and they took my airplane, and I became known to the entire Navy. They shut down the jet pipeline because of my crash.
Really?
Yeah, it was an inherent flaw in the F-9. Mm-hmm. They were all going to do it. And it was not something that was going to happen over time. It was all going to happen at once. The part was all made at the same time. It was an actuator in the tail, and it all was degrading at the same time.
Hmm.
It was all degrading at the same time, and so one crashed before they even shut the plane down.
Right.
So I became known throughout the Navy because they grounded the jet pipeline for months, and when I came back. I came back flying, I guess, 4 months later.
So how long were you in the hospital?
I was a month directly in the hospital. I was on convalescent leave for 3 months.
Okay.
And I got to feeling okay. There were things I knew later. When your burns heal, you don't get the skin back like it was there before.
Mm-hmm.
Something that started happening, even look now, is that, like when I get mosquito bites, I just mm-hmm. bleed on my arms.
Mm-hmm.
And when I used to work in the woods, my legs would start itching, and they'd itch till I bleed out. The skin wasn't as thick. And even today, I would have a farm, I get scratched easily, and things like that. So, you know, I never really recovered from that. The main thing I lost was maybe that thing, that the confidence that it won't happen to you, it was gone.
Right.
When I went, I knew it could happen to me, because it already had.
Yes.
And I watched people change in combat from the cocky fighter pilot to the pained look in the eyes and the stress line in the face after they got shot down. So it happened to other people besides me.
Right.
And so I went to Vietnam different than I was before that plane crash. And the one thing that was different was in the tiny cockpit of the A-4. I used to get claustrophobia at night and in the soup. And I didn't in other airplanes. So I owe a lot of fines. I felt terror, and I had no idea why.
Right.
It was on missions that didn't justify it.
Right.
I was not afraid in combat, but I was afraid in the airplane sometimes for no reason at all.
Yes, sir. Sir, why don't we take a break for a moment?
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Robert Lathrop. Today is May 18, 2004. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Lathrop is again in Sutherland, Oregon. Sir, let's pick up where we were yesterday. We had talked about the end of your training, you're getting ready to be shipped to Vietnam. I had another question about the crash that you described.
Yeah.
That must have been very emotionally traumatic to you.
Yeah.
Did it affect you about getting back in the cockpit and doing it again?
Only in the same plane. Once I switched planes, it didn't. What it did affect is I was hurt.
Yes.
And they didn't find all the injuries. And then I'd been burned. And that takes something out of you.
Yes.
Takes, I mean, I know now that over the years, those injuries have sapped energy. And I didn't know that at that time. So it did take something out of me when I got there. Plus, I got claustrophobia in small cockpits, which I hadn't had before.
Mm-hmm.
But I got my orders to Vietnam in that naval hospital before I even knew if I was going to live or not.
Wow.
And it shut down the Naval Training Command. It turned out to be an entrenching problem of all the airplanes, so my statement shut down the Naval Training Command.
So your crash perhaps saved other lives.
It saved a lot of their lives, probably, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because I think there was one more went down even before I stopped it 3 days later.
Mm-hmm. Do you still bear any scars from that today, that crash?
Oh, yeah. Not too much physically. I can see them, but most people can't. They turned white over the years.
Okay.
And I've always been afraid of fire, and even today, you know.
Yes, sir. So tell me, when you were released from the hospital, where did you go?
I had 3 months of convalescent leave.
Yes.
And I just went home, and I got feeling better, and I used to run.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I went and volunteered at the squadron because that was right before the 1967 war. And I had really was trained as an intelligence officer by my forestry stuff and then by taking the intelligence course. So what they had me do was, one thing I did was I just kept up with the intelligence reports coming in from the Mideast, and then I did some work for the squadron about 3 hours a day.
Okay. And you had your orders for Vietnam, correct?
Yeah. Actually, they didn't do that, but just a couple of times right then. There's a replacement air group. They usually didn't send people right out of flight training to it. They sent other pilots who hadn't flown the airplane, the A-4,
mm-hmm.
that had a lot of hours. But they sent three of us directly to that replacement air group, and we got about 40 hours in Yuma, Arizona, and then they put us in the ferry squadron to Vietnam. We picked up a bunch of hours flying across the ocean.
Right. Now, explain to the listeners of this what a ferry squadron is.
Well, the Navy has a ferry squadron, VRF-12, and that's a fixed-wing ferry squadron, and they assign pilots to it, temporary duty, to take planes from one place to the other. And in this case, we were taking planes from El Toro to Da Nang.
Okay.
And you're just assigned to it, as I say, for a short time, ferry the planes, and you go back to your regular squadron.
Okay.
And they do have some permanent pilots, but mostly they're temporary duty pilots. And so they transferred seven of us. We had six pilots and a spare to that squadron. And then we took a series of two-seat A-4s over that were used as air control planes in North Vietnam.
Right.
I didn't like that. That was worse than combat, flying over the ocean hour after hour in a single-engine airplane. And we lost one airplane that had the engine go bad in Guam. So we only got there with five, and we were on the runway when they captured the Pueblo, so we almost got vectored up there.
Wow.
And
let me ask, what happened to the pilot who didn't make it? Did he bail
out? No, the plane, it froze up on runway
as
he landed. It's usually when the bearings go out, it's not till you move the throttle in it. But he had to stay behind.
Okay.
And then the other five planes went on, and we went into Da Nang the second day of the Tet Offensive, and that was pretty traumatic.
I can imagine. How long did it take to fly over the Pacific in an A-4?
Oh, it takes different legs. About 7 hours to Hawaii and about 7 hours to Wake, which is just a tiny little spot in the water. And then I think it's four from Wake to Guam and a little less to the Philippines, and it's about 2.5 hours into Da Nang.
That's quite a trip.
Yeah, and it's all, there's nothing there, no ships.
Right. Tell me about your first impressions of Da Nang. This was in January or...
Yeah, well, I went in there as a student. It was unbelievable. There were planes taking off each direction. They were running airstrikes on tower frequency. This was the first day of the Tet Offensive. They were fighting on the perimeter.
Right.
And we just went in there. We couldn't even get a word in edgewise. And we came in there, and we just flew right over the base and out the other side because we couldn't get get a word in on the tower. So we just came in and landed.
Huh.
And we landed to the south. Uh-huh. And then taxied in over to the Marine line, which was on the west side of the base.
Right.
And then we just turned the planes over. Then we had to get home on our own.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we had Class 4 orders, so we were behind everybody else. And we went back to the Philippines on a C-130.
The very day?
We got off the plane, and 40 minutes later, we were back on a plane headed back to the Philippines.
Wow.
And then we had to manifest out of the big air base in the Philippines Air Force. And we came back around and landed in...
is it Clark you're talking about?
Yeah, Clark. Mm-hmm. Clark. We came and landed in Travis, and then we took a bus in and then back to Yuma.
Wow.
And then I got orders, and I was there a couple of weeks, and I went back overseas again.
Okay, and this time you were there to stay, was it?
Yeah, this time I was on a 13-month deployment, but it really added a couple months to my tour.
Yes. Tell me, do you remember what you saw that day when you flew into Da Nang? Could you describe the scene?
Well, they were talking on the radio. They were in airstrikes on a frequency. There were planes taking off and landing and helicopters and smoke on the south end of the runway where the fighting was. And you didn't see too much as what you heard on the radio, you know. But everything was really frenetic. There were, as I say, you could not even get your call to land in a radio. And there was just everything happening at once. And that pretty much was true year-round. Those bases had planes taken off and landing 24 hours a day. And the planes that were launched to North Vietnam for Big Cap were taken off. They always took off to the north, regardless of where everybody else was taken off.
Right.
So they'd be zipping by in one direction and accelerating up, and you'd be coming in the other. Mm-hmm. And there were all kinds of planes in the pattern. There were Sky Raiders from Vietnam, and there were F-106s for the Air Force, and Phantoms and A-6s. We were the only A-4s there, because the A-4s the Marines had were south, 40-some miles at Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
And so we brought those A-4s in, brand new planes. The others all beat up looking, you know. But it was pretty, I never seen anything like it.
Right. Well, when you got back to the United States, you had a couple of weeks before you were redeployed?
Right,
correct?
And I flew a couple times a day.
Okay.
I didn't even have 100 hours when I went back to Vietnam.
Wow, wow. What did your family think about you having to go back, or actually picking up for the first time going for your tour? What were their thoughts? Do you remember?
Well, since we'd been dealing with everybody else, it was a known. And I took my family up to, most people took their families home. You see, in the Marines, we went over as individual replacements. In the Navy, they went over as squadron on ships.
Mm-hmm.
So they would go to a base, and their wives would stay at that base while the squadron was overseas. That wasn't true in the Marine Corps.
Right.
We went over as an individual replacement, so most of us took our wives home. My wife was pregnant about 6 months or 7 months, and so she went home. We got an apartment, and then we had about 20 days leave. And the last day before I had a son, I went up in the mountains with a friend of mine and showed my son the places we'd been, and we stayed up and drank champagne and stuff till about 3 o'clock in the morning. I slept for a couple hours, and then I just went out to the airport, you know, and it was pretty hard, you know. I'd already been hurt and climbing on that plane and looking back. But just as soon as the plane lifted off, I shifted my mind. You just sort of have to shut off. You just have to shut off what's here because you had to deal with what's there, and that's
right.
Pretty much what people did. There just wasn't. You couldn't live in two worlds at once.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the flight over? What was that like?
Well, actually, I was the senior officer on the pilot. Because I'd gone to basic school, because of rapid promotion, I was a senior captain. And I took over 243 individual replacements, and I was the commanding officer. And I was responsible for them till we got there. And so when we took off, I called ahead to Hawaii, and I sealed the base.
Mm-hmm.
When the base was... We got there, we had guards in, but we did have like 7 or 9 people try to come get a buy a ticket back to the United States. Now, these were all individual replacements.
Right.
We weren't going over as a group. And so what we had was we had people going into I Corps and during the Tet Offensive. So we knew what we were getting in for because it had been on TV. I had seen planes from my squadron on TV. Dropping in Hawaii, and that was a siege of Quezon was on.
Yes.
And so I got in. I actually took them across, and we landed in Hawaii, and then we went all the way, and we went into Kadena,
okay.
The big Air Force base on Okinawa. And then they disbanded everybody except the Marines were put together on a bus, and they were taken to Camp Hansen and locked up. I mean, within the base, the only people that could leave the base were staff NCOs and officers.
Hmm.
And what they did is they gave us a prep for Vietnam there. We went in there, and the first thing they did is something that had already been done is they gave us all the shots and made us sick, you know.
Right.
But they did something that nobody else did. They gave us a history of Vietnam and the history of the Buddhist religion, and they told us how Buddhists related to each other. And a lot of the frustrations of the troops of watching one village being blown up while the others out doing their patties was alleviated because we knew that they had self-enlightenment religion, and that village was in another world.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They aren't like us. It's not a, you know, do unto others as you do unto you. And we started picking that up, too, because they'd use their own people as shields,
right.
You know, the enemy. And so when I went in there and I knew the history of the people, I did have an advantage over a lot of Army and Air Force and other people and junior Marines, that I knew how those people related to each other, and I wasn't as frustrated by the things I saw where they seemed so totally uncaring as I realized it was their basic religion. And there was once an interview, I'll quote, it was of a young woman, it's hard to say, 14 to 24, and they asked her, and this I saw this interview.
This is a Vietnamese woman?
This was a Vietnamese woman. She lived south of Chu Lai, and this was the interview. She said, they were asked, "Where have you been?" And she said, "Everywhere." And I said, "Oh, you've been out of Vietnam?" "No." "Have you been to Saigon?" It was about 300 miles south. "No." Well, "Have you been to Quang Nai?" Which is about 5 miles south. "No." "Have you been to the ocean?" Which is just over the hill. "No." It's just, "Have you been to that village over there?" "No." "Where have you been?" "Everywhere." And the reason is she has been everywhere within herself.
Right.
They did not relate to that village over there. Their relations were blood relations, and that village over there wasn't a blood relation. It didn't exist.
Right.
And that drove me nuts, too, because their interrelationships were odd. I'd gone through flight training with Vietnamese, and they were, of course, of the upper class. But their relationship struck me as odd, too, you know, not something I was used to. They have a concept called face. Have you ever talked to that with anybody else?
Oh, yes. Saving face and so forth.
Making face, where everything they do has to have an honor with it, and you'd be giving orders to somebody, and when they started losing face, they'd just go blank, and when that happened, you might as well just shut up, because they weren't paying any attention to what you say, and they weren't going to do it.
Right.
And so you had to always get them into the situation of making face, because if they lose face, they wouldn't do it.
Right.
And that even, there were things happened, like in Japan, while we were there, two trains ran together. And it was because one of the engineers on the train didn't want to lose face, because he didn't want to admit he made a mistake. And that was a really hard thing to deal with those groups of people, is you're telling them something, but all of a sudden you're talking to yourself. They just shut you off. You know?
Right, right. This briefing that you received on...
Yeah, I had gone through both infantry training and flight training with them. And so and then we had been briefed on that all the time.
Uh-huh.
How the Oriental sink. But when you get into a war, it's a different thing. Where we would lose respect for them simply because they didn't care. You know, the North Vietnamese didn't care if they took a group of villagers and put them up and charged out ahead of them, you know, and the villagers led the troops into combat, or they'd set their... That's why the My Lai massacre occurred. They were set up in that village, you know, and they were set up in villages everywhere. So, when we attacked the enemy, quite often we were attacking a village with people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Usually by the time the airplane got there, there wasn't anything left, but it had been a village. So they were intermixed, and then you couldn't tell who was who.
Mm-hmm.
Some things they did, we recognized that when we were going to get hit, the bar girls didn't come into the bar, you know.
Right.
So I never particularly learned to deal with it because of the fact I couldn't see how people could be so uncaring about other people. And so what happened is we became numb to it, too. It didn't take very long to where they said, the hell with them. I mean, I don't know how many of our troops and soldiers actually respected the Vietnamese as people. I mean, they were so alien to our culture.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the country. It was a series of isolated hamlets put together by a border with several different kinds of people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And landlords controlling most of the land. So it was hard. It was hard to identify with the... I could see what maybe if like what's happening in Iraq is there, where the people are so alien to the people, our soldiers just give up trying to deal with them and develop their own methods. But that's what happened there. Most of our troops just got to where they didn't respect the people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I shouldn't say most. A lot of them did.
Right.
They didn't make any decisions. I mean, I just got to where I said, I'm not going to make any judgments here, but I'm not going to trust anybody either.
Right. Did you make that decision early on, or was that something that you
made I started out by being the intelligence officer, so right away,
mm-hmm.
I could see what was happening.
Right.
So I knew it before I went there because I talked to other troops, but I didn't deal much with the Vietnamese except those who worked on our base at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see it, though. I could see it. We didn't have enough pilots, when I went into Da Nang, and you had to hitchhike everywhere. I guess you know that. You went into Da Nang, you had to find your own squadron, which mine was at Chu Lai. As you went to air freight and you put your name on a manifest, and whatever plane came in, that's where you went to Chu Lai. And I went down to Chu Lai on a C-117, must have been 110 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
This
is when you first got in country.
Yeah, I first went into country.
So you went in and landed at Da Nang?
I went to Da Nang. I spent one night right next to the runway there in the transit barracks. And from the time you're there, you're beat and wet and dirty.
Yeah.
You know, and he just didn't sleep, and so I flew down on a nice C-117. This was a Navy version of the DC-3, and landed. And by golly, if I didn't get met by a guy with name Chief Warrant Officer Lathrop, same name as me, and he was from Texas.
Huh.
And he took me to my squadron, and I checked in, and they said, "You don't have enough hours to fly in combat." You've never even flown the single seat A-4, so we're sending you to Japan. So I went to bed, planning to get on a plane to go to Japan. And Chuck Porterfield got killed right then. And he did something that I never would do. I mean, right then I thought, I'm not going to do what that guy did. And he was real careful. And what happened is he pushed his throttle forward. And he didn't have the speed at midfield to get air, what the book says you should have to get airborne.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulled his power back and missed the arresting gear and blew up at the end. And when I heard, then I became immediately qualified. And right then,
that was at night. That happened the night.
That happened. That happened just about the time they told me I was going to go to Japan.
Okay.
But I made the decision, and I said I would never. I never check my line checks. When I pushed the throttle forward, that's where it was going to stay. When I got to end the runway, that's when the decisions were made. I wasn't going to pull my throttle back.
Right.
And we had all these rules to do. I bypassed those that I picked and chose the rules I flew. And one was that I wasn't going to pull my throttle back if I didn't have my airspeed at the middle of the field.
Right.
And end up like him. And I made a lot of other decisions. I didn't use the autopilot because I didn't trust it. And so I tried to simplify combat by knocking out those things, those things that could cause me harm. And I started doing that right away.
Now, is this in March 1968?
And it was March, about March 22nd or 3rd, 1968.
Okay.
So what they did is that they qualified me immediately, and they let me fly three flights in a TA-4F in the back seat. I didn't know where I was for a while. We went here, Da Nang would be there on one side and the other, and we were upside down and bombing. So it came up in 3 days. I got my first flight in a single-seat A-4 on a combat mission, and it's a different, sort of a little different plane. A single seat, a smaller cockpit, that the canopy didn't close automatically. I had to pull it manually closed. I didn't know how to turn the air conditioning on, so I about blew my ears out when I did. But my first mission was in the siege of Quezon. That was a hell of a way to come into Vietnam.
Absolutely. What happened? Tell me what that first mission was like.
Well, I went with a guy named Bob Drumfeller, and he briefed me pretty intensely, something that ended later on. And we took off, and we flew up the coast, and I didn't exactly know where I was, but when I got over Quezon, you could see it was a big battle. It's sort of shocking to fly up the coast the first time, because you could hear all this radio traffic, people doing this and calling artillery in and naval gunfire, and there's airstrikes you can see, and going into Quezon looked like, I mean, just solid bomb craters going across the DMZ, and Quezon is this little tiny base, looks like a dash in the page of a book, and it's all surrounded by enemy trenches and gun craters, and this tiny little base there, and all of a sudden, I was rolling in, and something happened, and this might be the fact that I had already been hurt and keyed up. The first time I come, I had two napalms and 400 or 500 bombs. So I was sort of nervous going up, but just as soon as I came up to roll in, all of a sudden everything went dead calm.
Really?
Just like I was made to be there. It was like the perfect peace, and everything went into slow motion. I rolled the plane inverted and pulled the gun sight down. It was about 3,000, 2,000 feet. Pulled the gun. It was guns firing all over, and I never ever saw the bullets going by. I always focused. Pulled the gun, and I could see all the ground fire on the ground, and everything was slow, and I came in, and I saw that. I thought you couldn't miss, and I came in, and when you drop napalm, you go, and 500-pound bombs that are retarded, you drive right into the ground until you're so scared you think you're going to hit it. You hit, and then you pull. You pull, and you try not to hit the ground. You pull out about 50 feet. So I was right on the deck, right at Quezon.
Right.
And I pulled up to the left, and I was below Quezon. And I pulled up and over Quezon and climbed up over Quezon what little I could to get shield.
Mm-hmm.
But I had never been there. It was foggy, and I pull up. Instead of joining up on my wing with, I joined up on an F-100. and he was headed the same way. And so I was talking to one plane and flying on another, and then I saw I was on a wrong plane.
Uh-huh.
And then I saw my other plane over about, three or four clicks to the left and flew across and got and flew back and landed. And that was your introduction.
Wow.
They assumed by then you knew what you're doing, because about an hour later I was doing the same thing.
Wow.
And that went on straight. Nothing stopped. You just flew from day and night. You just did the duty. You were here and there. And when I first got there, we didn't have air-conditioned hooches. We had these Southeast Asia hoots with screens on the side, and there were rats running around, and there was a huge generator next to you, and there were six officers and 12 enlisted men living in those filthy things.
Right.
You couldn't sleep, and we were wrecking planes because people were so tired.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was beat in about three or four missions because those things are exhausting.
Would you fly one mission per day?
No, we flew whatever we needed per day. I flew as low as zero and as high. Well, the trouble is a day ends at midnight.
Okay.
You can fly two missions a day and fly four missions in 16 hours.
Right.
Yeah, but we flew after about, I can remember, it was on my 14th mission when I taxied out. You know, I said, I got another year of this. And so after I landed, I realized that I could not look ahead to what I'd seen already.
Yeah.
And I did not want to deal with what I'd seen already. And right then, I made a decision. And it was maybe not conscious, but that's the way I lived. When I landed, there was no past. There was no future. The next time I worried about flying combat was when I pushed the throttle forward on the next mission. In between, there was nothing to deal with. You know, I simply lived for the moment. And once I landed, there was no tomorrow. There was no nothing. But we flew so much that I was so tired that I just ached. And you'd climb into one cockpit and climb out of the other. And pretty soon you flew so much. I mean, you're flying 60 missions a month. And you're so tired that it just becomes you're sort of like in a dream world where you're going all the time. You had to stand the duty every 2 days. That was 6 hours. Then you had a collateral duty.
Mm-hmm.
My collateral duty was a bad one. I was just not, since I was a trained intelligence officer, I asked to be the intelligence officer. But when I started getting my intelligence reports and reading what was going on, I would have preferred not to know that, a lot of that stuff. And I couldn't talk to them. I could only communicate to others what they needed to know.
Right.
And I was getting intelligence reports that started at my perimeter and covered the entire Eastern Hemisphere. So I wasn't just finding out what was in Vietnam. I was finding out what was going on in other places.
Tell me about this was collateral duty that you had. How many hours a day would you spend doing that?
I didn't have time to spend much time, but all I had to do was read three intelligence reports a day. I had a clerk to do it.
Okay.
And my clerk did all of it. The biggest thing you could do was lose a classified report. You see, in a squadron, most of our classified documents had nothing to do with intelligence. We had all these manuals for guns, all of our ordnance on our airplanes, and then they were classified. And they would come in, and they would replace a page in a manual. And so what would happen is he would log in the page, and he would insert the page in the manual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then he would take the other classified page and put it in a burn pile and then document it out. Okay, so, and that was also true of intelligence reports. They came in, held, And once they were no longer germane, he put them in the burn pile. Then I checked to see that everything came in, went out, and then I went and burned them so that we never had anything on record. Big piles of old intelligence reports. And that was considered a real responsible job. If
right.
you lost an intelligence report, you're in big trouble.
What was your clearance?
Top secret.
Okay.
We did have some people's secret clearances, but most were top secret. And
how did you get this position, this job? Were you asked, or did they just?
Well, I ended up quite highly trained with a forestry degree, which is just like intelligence. And then 6 months, well, 9 months of infantry training. And then I took the intelligence course, 40-week intelligence course, while I was in the Naval Hospital. So I was trained probably better than the division intelligence officer. Because in the Marine Corps, they don't have intelligence officers as an MOS.
Mm-hmm.
All intelligence officers have a collateral duty. In the Marine Corps, however, flying is the collateral duty. My main duty was being an intelligence officer. Flying was a collateral duty.
Okay.
And so that took priority. However, I didn't spend much time on it because I did have a clerk.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we just climbed from one cockpit into the other, and when we were off, we went up to the club.
Right.
And what happened is I went out the first day because I was thirsty and got a drink of water out of a water buffalo. That's the last time I can remember drinking water the whole time I was there. And I drank beer and pop.
Uh-huh.
Milk with milk at the club, and we had a nice officers club. It had a big grass roof, and it was like something you'd see in Hawaii, you know.
Right.
Tile floor, Vietnamese built it, and it had a bar, and it was right on the ocean, and you could sit out there and watch the South China Sea. And when I first got there, there wasn't much place to wash up, so I used to go get out of my plane. You'd smell so bad. I just took a bar of soap, went out and swam in the ocean in my flight suit and underwear and everything. And of course, my flight suits became all, you know, stiff and everything. But about a month after we got there, or 2 months maybe, they built us Quonset huts with air conditioning so we could sleep.
Right.
And when that happened, and I saw that water, people saw the water coming out of the air conditioner, we took an ammo can, and we got fresh water that way. And that's where we wash our clothes, is in that fresh water under the ammo can. Then our flight suits weren't so stiff, but we flew so much that green turned brown. And we literally lived in those things. We never wore utilities. We had flight boots, a flight suit, and then we would wear the Marine Corps cover with our rank on the front until we got into the cockpit. Then our flight suits were, our flight gear was cut away. It was just the straps, and all the nylon was out of it, except on the G suit. That way it didn't get so hot.
Mm-hmm.
And we carried, in addition to wearing your torso harness and G-suit, we carried a survival vest with a pistol and all this stuff in it and in case you got shot down.
Right.
And when you got on that plane, you could hardly move with all that junk on, and I was so tall that I couldn't reach around to touch some of the stuff. I would have to turn things on to the left with my right arm because I couldn't pull my left arm back.
Mm-hmm.
And as we went along, we started getting plain. When I first got there, we had pretty much all Marine Corps A4Es, but we started getting planes from the Navy. So we started getting planes with different kinds of engines and different type of cockpit configurations. And toward the end of my tour, there wasn't any two planes alike.
Hmm.
We had on and off switches, and we didn't know if they were on or off. We have things in there that we didn't even know what they were, you know, and so. And most of the stuff didn't work. Well, if you had a radio, a TACAN, which you found yourself around, and an IFF, that was considered adequate. You didn't have to have anything else that worked with the gun system. And
mm-hmm.
so we flew a lot of missions with nothing working but our basic basic, really you just needed a radio. You could fly around without TACAN, VFR, because we flew in an area. We used to take off out of Chu Lai, the southern part of Vietnam, and the missions were just canned. You'd taxi out, if it was a hot pad or anything, and you'd get on a runway, and the first plane would take off, and it was so hot that one plane would take off, and you'd see him coming down a runway
mm-hmm.
from the distance, and he wouldn't get off the ground. He'd just rotate, and then the gear would come up, and he'd still be like 6 feet above the ground. And then as the plane accelerated, the noses start coming down. And as he got closer to you, he realized he was about going to run over, and he went by you about 12 feet, mm-hmm. cocked up, coming at 200 knots. And at the south end of the field, they turned. And turned, and then another plane would come right behind him, and you'd join up at about 600 feet going the opposite direction. And I was the intelligence officer squadron. I'm the only one that knew why we turned that way in the south and we didn't turn that way in the north. And that's because if you didn't keep proceeding to the south, you ended up in an area where you could take a lot of ground fire right in our traffic pattern. Because
mm-hmm.
our base was under fire.
Right.
Not just periodically. It was periodic, but not just, you know, in some area it wasn't necessary. They killed our GCA crew once. The runway lights were shot out once. I came back with no runway lights. You'd break out of the soup. You had no idea what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you heard Chu Lai rockets, they abandoned everything. And once I came in, took the arresting gear, and they abandoned everything. Nobody there to pull me out. Other planes coming in, so I had to leave my lights on just like a big aiming stake out there.
Right.
And we took ground fire and right in the traffic pattern, but it didn't affect jets much, man, pretty much at night. But I can remember coming in there and always wondering what was going to happen, because you'd break out of the soup at, say, 800 feet, and all of a sudden these 2 million candle power flares would go off. Because there was fighting at the end of the runway, and when those things went off, you were so dazzled you couldn't even see your instruments, you know. You had to turn the lightning light or whatever they call it on so you could see your instruments until the dazzling went away and came in and landed,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Can you tell me how, when you first arrived there, Chu Lai, how the other men in the unit accepted you and how you...
I didn't know one single person in the squadron, and everybody was an individual placement. People came and went, and they accepted you because you were on their wing.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people who were not very good pilots who were not accepted. And as far as personal relationships, pretty soon people started coming in that I knew, and that's who you sort of palled around with. But like if you went somewhere or you did something, there was not any big length of time to break down the barriers. Like you were immediately like good friends all your life. You might go up to Japan or something, and the guys you're with you'd never seen before, you dealt with them just like you'd lived all your life, talked about everything, your marriage problems, and anything that there was an immediate breakdown. So you immediately people just opened up to you.
Right.
That was not so much true maybe of the CO and the operations officer. It was pretty much true of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I only flew like 10 missions, and I got sent to Japan with two majors. And right away, we ended up hitchhiking to Japan, and we landed from a mission. All of a sudden, we were gone. We just had time to pack a bag, and when we landed in Tokyo in the airport,
mm-hmm.
and here we got off the plane, and here we are in utilities with a soft cap carrying a pistol right in the middle of Tokyo International Airport,
mm-hmm.
and then we went out to a training facility for sea survival. And when they sent you out of country, they didn't tell you when to come back.
Okay.
They just left, and you came back when you wanted to. And Finally, people started not coming back, so they limited you to $200. So that, however long you can make $200 last, that's how long you can stay out of country. But you hitchhiked everywhere.
Okay, so you went to Japan for training?
I went to Japan to be trained in survival over the ocean.
Okay.
I went to Japan to be trained more than once. I also went to Japan to ferry a plane up once. Mm-hmm. And then another time I went to Okinawa to be trained as a battleship and air control spotter.
Okay.
And so I went up there three times. Once I was getting battle fatigue and they sent me out, and it was worse flying up there. We flew through typhoons and landed at the wrong base. And I think I sent you the book I wrote about some of this stuff.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'll tell you what amounted to is you were in that airplane so much it was like your home.
Hmm.
And I got to doing things. I got to flying to do. I got to be able to do things I never could do before. For example, when I was strafing. You come in as you're strafing, as you're accelerating, the plane tends to walk up all the time because you're accelerating. And so I started accelerating at a 90-degree angle. And then I said, I started strafing inverted because then the plane tended to pull down, you know. So here you are at 500 feet above the ground inverted, you know. And then, but I learned to do that, then I could hit the target. And I can remember once rolling into a mission where I knew I could get out, but I didn't know why. And there was a mountain at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever saw the bridges of Tokari, how you go down to the bottom of a canyon.
Yes.
Okay, well, here the enemy was in the bottom of a canyon, and I went right to the bottom of a canyon. On each side of me was a mountain like 4,000 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did was pull my nose up and did like a wing over the mountain. I pulled up, and I couldn't keep my upright, so I rolled inverted, and I went up the ground, right over the ground, inverted, and pulled down the other side. That's not something I was trained to do. Those are things I started doing because I got to feel the plane better.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be a pretty good pilot. If you weren't, you couldn't hit the target, for one thing, and you got to be known for that. We had some pilots that weren't too good, and we had some officers that weren't too good. And then we had this situation is we had regular officers and we had reserve officers. Okay, and the reserve officers were the captains and below. And regular officers tended to be majors and above. I don't know that we had any, we maybe had a couple, three career officers among our junior officers. Most were not.
Mm-hmm.
Most were reserves who would have been second and first lieutenants, except I made captain in 23 months.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a captain, I was a senior captain. So
right.
I spent most of the time in the Marine Corps as a senior captain.
How was morale?
Pardon?
How was morale?
Meli?
No, morale amongst the troops.
Oh, morale?
Yes, sir.
In the squadron, it seemed to me like those guys, I mean, I always really respected those guys. Went out there with their basic crescent wrench and screwdriver and hammer and fixed our planes, and I'd say it was real good in the squadron. Those they really respected the pilots, and so the morale was good in the air wing.
Okay.
And they were so busy they didn't have time to think. You know, they were out there. But I can remember those kids out there, and when I flew transports, those troops from the Army, they looked like they were 40 years old. I mean, they lines in their face, you know, and slim and sort of walking about half tired. And they'd climb up there in their dirty old utilities to strap you in and ask you where you're going, you know, and you'd tell them. And I used to brief them about once a month about what we did. I'd bring the whole squadron of enlisted men in, and I'd take an intelligence map and I'd show where the enemy was and everything, which didn't set things very good with them, because when I did, there was enemy. You could see from where I was, you know, the enemy right around our base.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a big mountain to the west of us. And behind that mountain was were massive enemy forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ran arc lights and shot battleship stuff back there. And these were division headquarters and things. But so they saw that was there, you know. And that they did not realize until I gave those intelligence reports how important the things they worked on in the plane were, like the TACAN. We found all of our targets by our TACAN. That's tactical air navigation. That gives you a bearing and distance.
Right.
And when you went in, see, all of our flights were controlled from the ground, except North Vietnam. You went in, and when you took off, you had a mission. Contact Helix 2-3 on button gold, okay, and that was a coded frequency. And then what you do is you take off, join up, and every after you got airborne, you went under radar control so that you didn't fly into artillery and other planes. But all the planes went up and down the coast, and there was a lot of planes up and down. And so you flew up the coast, and then you went directly inland to your target. And then you'd pick up an air controller, and you'd call him, and you'd say, Helix 20, this is Hellborn 530 feet. I have two A4s with Delta 7, Delta 9 for your control. And that would give him the coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then when he came up, he'd say, Hellborn 5i9, I have a mission. Are you ready to copy? And you'd say, Roger, the lead would copy.
Forward air controller.
Yeah, this is the forward air controller, or
right.
The ground controller.
Right.
Sometimes they were ground. And then he'd say, are you ready to copy? You'd say, Roger. And he says, what we have here is an enemy battalion in a fortified village. Run-in heading will be 270, left-hand pull. Friendlies will be at 2 o'clock at 200 meters. Ground fire, expect heavy. Report ready to, you're cleared to drop, that's what they'd say. Sometimes they wouldn't say cleared to drop. They'd say, we'll give you clearance later, and you'd roll in and you wouldn't be cleared at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when that was happening, you had friendly troops moving out of an area, you know. So when you rolled in, usually you said dash one in hot, and you'd go in and you'd call it and say dash one off cold. And the dash was like 265-1 and 265-2 would
right.
be your call signs. We just used dash one and two within the flight.
Right.
Mainly if you just use the number, you couldn't a lot of times understand it. And the radios were a weak spot always, any ground and air. That was one of the problems we always had with avionics, radios and things. There would be a lot of reasons we couldn't complete missions.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they wouldn't work. I took off one time and it was at night. And I took off and I lost everything. I lost everything but my radio.
Oh.
And I was in the soup. And the way I got back is I flew over Da Nang, and they took me from one GCA to the other of Chu Lai, the ground controlled approach, and I came in with all my ordnance. Another time, I took off, and I was at Da Nang at night, at about 8,000, 10,000 feet, dropping radar bombs. And all my bombs dropped off the left wing and nothing on the right. Well, you can manually control them. You can go out and you can pull and blow your racks and bombs off. When I did, I blew my left rack off, but not my right. So I had three bombs and a rack on the right. Well, the plane would hardly fly.
Right.
Well, I got the plane in, but when I was coming in and got down into landing configuration, the plane wouldn't turn left. It was an awkward thing that was down by the wing, nose to the left, full left rudder, full left. And I made an arresting gear, and after I landed and had time to look in the book, the plane isn't supposed to fly. So, and people brought a lot of planes back in pretty bad shape.
How did you get it to land?
I took the arresting gear,
okay.
In flight arrestment, and went up on one wing. There was a lot of close calls. I took off one night and blew a tire. And went into resting gear at 150 knots, and it was a real ride. Not all they do is shove you another airplane. I mean, the Marine Corps was merciless that. They expected you. They didn't expect you to refuse. And I can remember flying that second mission that night after that happened. I couldn't even remember it. I was so tired.
Wow.
And I was exhausted. I just ached. There were times when I'd lay down and I said, I'm going to try to stay awake, and I couldn't. But I started I'd go through periods of being really keyed up, like that was the battle fatigue kicking in. And other people did too, and we fought it with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And the troops fought it with drugs. But I got pretty bad for a while when we were flying three missions a day, and I mentioned that, boy, they sent me out of country for 2-3 weeks, and I did. I got over it.
Right.
And I came right back into combat, but I stayed on the edge of it the rest of the time I was there.
Can you describe what you mean? You fought it with alcohol and the battle fatigue? What was that like?
Battle fatigue is just bad nerves. You start to, you're just keyed up. You can't calm down, you know.
Right.
You can get scared and not be afraid, but you just couldn't release. You were just tense all the time, and it could get pretty bad. And we had people sent home.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you one way it happens is the people get blasted. I got blasted there once, and that does it. I've seen people go straight from normal to shaking like a leaf, catching a full blast.
What do you mean, getting blasted?
Well, an explosion hits next to you. And I got blasted once when I went up the plane that had crashed to try to get the pilot out, and the thing blew up.
Right.
It hit me. It didn't feel like noise or anything. It felt like I got hit by a wall of air. And I shook for 3 days, you know. But I saw people, World War One, where they had shell shock.
Yes.
I've seen the movies of that where they're shaking and everything.
Yes.
That's what blasting will do to you. Shell shock, combat fatigue, combat neurosis, and PTSD are all the same thing. And PTSD isn't delayed. It just gets worse over time. And that's why people use drugs in Vietnam, to calm down, you know. In World War II, they found out you could only last about 3 or 4 months in combat, and you weren't worth a damn anymore. And they kept us in combat in the Marine Corps the whole 13 months we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had they don't advertise. People kill themselves, so they didn't have to go back to combat, you know, into combat. And they just refused, you know, refused, you know. And we had a mutiny. Our pilots, we had a helicopter called the H-46 is still flying, and we had pilots refuse to fly them because they started splitting in two. So there was a, you know, we were pushing things to the limit. And there's one thing you could see, especially any time you flew around the Army, they had many more helicopters and much more artillery to support their troops than we did. That the Marines had to do things with people that they did with artillery and tanks and things like that. We didn't have the support, because a lot of our support comes from the ocean on ships. And the Army had a lot more supporting units. They had so many helicopters, they almost flew into each other. There were so many of them. We didn't have that many.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the worst part of the area. We weren't there alone. The Army and the Armies were there. But I Corps, when I was there, was just one big battle.
Right. Can you describe what a typical day was like for you from the time you got up until the time you tried to get it back to bed?
Well, we followed four things. One, for 4 days, we'd be on the hot pad. For 8 days, we'd fly scheduled missions. And for 4 days, we'd fly nights. So they were different, but on the hot pad missions, you stood duty for 6 hours on and 6 hours off. And what you did is you took those were the missions where they needed people emergency. We had planes loaded with different things. What you do is you wait in the ready room. You get a hot pad launch, you'd go out and you go out and you get in the cockpit and you check in. You say, 532-1, are you up? And they say, up. And then you call Chulai Tower. This is Hellborn 536. Active taxi takeoff, active scramble, and they say you're cleared for taxi takeoff, but you take out and you taxi fast, you hit the runway, you wouldn't stop. You go into position and hit the power, and you hit the power and you had to do all your checks. And then the number one plane that would get a thumbs up from one or two, and he'd be off, and when he lifted up, number two is off, and you're off to the target.
Mm-hmm.
It takes about 5 minutes to get out there, and then you're full speed to the target, and you do whatever you're told.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the next type of mission were the scheduled missions, and those tended to be a lot of times where we flew a lot of planes to an individual battle. So you would know when, so you would get up in the morning or whenever you got up, and you'd go to a brief. Okay, now we were about 2 miles from our flight line. Now we'd have to catch a ride, hitchhike with the Army or something down to the plane, and then you'd check a plane out. You flew a different plane every time.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd taxi out, then you'd go fly your mission, and you would be set. It was canned from takeoff to touchdown. You'd control, and you'd go in, and you'd hit the target, and then you'd come back, and you'd go home and land. And you usually had two scheduled missions a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew early, so people from 4 in the morning to, like, 2 in the afternoon, and from 2 in the afternoon to 9 or 10 at night. And then when you had night missions, those were radar missions where you flew alone. And I hated them the worst because of the weather. You'd taxi out there, and it'd be 300-foot overcast and raining, and you'd push the throttle forward, pull into the soup, and the planes were beat up, and then you fly alone. And a lot of times in North Vietnam, and you're up there totally by yourself, tired, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
You usually flew 2 a night, and the weather was abominable. The summer monsoon, the thunderstorms would be sitting right off the coast, so you had to penetrate a thunderstorm line going out, then going into the target, then coming back home, and a lot of times the base was socked in, and you'd have to shoot a GCA, and back you go under the wet runway, and I think all of our night runways were arrested. All of our wet runway, crosswind, and night landings were arrested landings, as I recall. Remember, we were Navy aviators, so we made a lot of arrested landings.
Right.
Dozens of them. Any time you had a problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't like those. Then you had the night hot pad life missions, and that's when you went out at night when there were troops in contact. They were always hairy. You were down in the mountains at night. You couldn't see anything. You were dropping against the black ground in a strobe light. And you had your high drag ordnance, and that's the stuff that's delivered at 500 feet, and you pull out at 50. And those were always high drag ordnance stuff. They were right down in the mountains at night. They were bad, but you didn't get many of them either.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell me about the enemy fire and what you faced.
Well, they varied from nothing to so many guns you couldn't see them on the horizon. When Roy Schmidt was one of my class members, got shot down. And, they surrounded him. There were so many guns, you couldn't see the end of them. And the same way was true at Quezon. And they didn't always shoot at you in North Vietnam, but when they decided to shoot at you in North Vietnam, it looked like the lights of a major city, and they were big flashes. So you could see those flashes from dusk till bright day from the ground, and even sometimes in the day. But when they were there, I used to wonder how many hundreds or thousands of people were down there. You know, but when I rolled in to try to get knocked down the ground fire for Roy Schmidt, I mean, I couldn't have knocked it down with a nuclear weapon. Same way at Quezon. And in North Vietnam, the same thing. But it wasn't always there. Quite often we'd be attacking where there would be an enemy unit, but we wouldn't see the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the fire was reported by the controller a lot of times. And about three-quarters of our missions we got fired at.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it was small arms, 50. I can remember one night mission where I could see the Quad 50 shooting at us. There must have been a couple thousand guns shooting at us, and I could actually see the Quad 50s tracking me, you know. It was only like 600 feet. And you could see that. If you could see the flashes, what you couldn't see was the tracers going by. For example, I took a guy out once in a two-seat plane and made a movie. And I was amazed. There's all these tracers around the airplane, and I never saw them on one mission.
Hmm.
I just cut them out, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew to exhaustion, and I since I was an intelligence officer, I started computing things. I knew when a plane took off what the probability was that that plane would still be around at the end of the year. I knew when a pilot took off in our squadron what his probability was of getting shot down and what his probability was of getting shot down and captured or killed. And it was 1 in 5, your chances of getting shot down, and 1 in 5 if shot down killed. So your chances of getting shot down was 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the next squadron where your chances of getting shot down were about 80%. And so I could keep track of that work because I always had the number of missions flown per day, the number of planes shot down, where they were shot down. I had all this stuff. And I also had things I didn't want to know, like what was happening to our prisoners on the ground. I don't remember any pilot ever getting shot down in South Vietnam. And when the enemy got to them, that they were ever captured. They killed them, and we'd get the bodies back. And that's something else. I don't remember too many prisoners being taken by the enemy of us or mm-hmm. us of the enemy, because I would talk to our ground troops.
Right.
One reason was is Vietnam was a war of small units.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a war of, like, when we fought in Europe, we fought with squadrons and divisions of airplanes. And when we were fighting in Europe, we were not fighting with companies and platoons. We were fighting with armies and corps, you know, and multiple armies. We hit Normandy with not only, I think we hit two corps.
Yes.
Two corps, you know. And we were, a lot of stuff in Vietnam was being done by patrols with 5 and 6 people.
Did you see that as a problem?
Well, it was that type of war.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and so when it came to get, there was no way for them to bring prisoners back. And I don't know that the enemy took many prisoners. Some of those things didn't show up realistic. Because we didn't know, you know, there was a lot of questions. And there were also things there that I didn't understand then that I understand now.
Right.
And there were things there that had nothing to do with Vietnam that I shouldn't have known.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there were 2 other wars going on while we were there that never made the news. And I imagine that's happening now. There was one between Russia and China, a border war, and another between Pakistan and India.
Right.
And so I knew about a lot of stuff that had nothing to do with Vietnam.
Did that make your job in Vietnam more difficult or more easier?
I would just assume after a while, I was pretty much numb to anything. I could read anything or hear anything, and I had no emotion. And that's something that happens, I think, to everybody.
Right.
I think you become overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And you just have to accept something and deal with it later.
Right.
So you can see the worst thing you got. You got to put it out of your mind and go fly another mission.
How did you deal with death?
I didn't deal with it.
I mean, the idea of you being shot down or your fellow pilots being shot down or knowing what you were doing on the ground to others?
I didn't think about it.
Okay.
I had to think about it when it happened, but I'll tell you how they did it. We had planes take off and get shot down. We didn't get the opportunity to deal with it unless we were a wingman or the duty officer, because what would happen is that the plane wouldn't come back, okay, and it would still be listed on the board, and there'd be a telephone call.
Right.
And the duty officer would get up and erase the name, and they'd go in and remove the guy's personal possessions, go through them. That's all we did. And that's the way it was dealt with. You couldn't deal with it. You simply didn't deal with it, and you just shut that off and dealt with it later, which is one reason that people started getting screwed up years later when this stuff starts coming out, because what happens is you bury this and you become numb. When you come back to society, you're still numb. But you can't hold all that in. I see it in my, I have an uncle from World War II. He never talked about the war, but as he got older and didn't have the strength, that's all he talked about. And it takes energy to hold that in. And and you have the conditioned responses of combat. Battle fatigue and PTSD cause a change in personality. Your adrenaline goes sky high. And so your tendency is to run away, or if you're the type of person that charges and attacks, you'll destroy the enemy. If you run away, you're probably going to become a casualty. Then it comes back to normal. In Vietnam, you didn't have time to come back to normal. It went up and it come a little down to normal, and you'd be back up pretty soon. You're up all the time, and you're highly alert, and you, the fight or flight syndrome reduces. You don't get afraid anymore. You get mad. And if you stay that way long enough, it's irreversible. You get mad, and you stay mad. And you stay aggressive. So when you come back to society, you don't get afraid anymore. When somebody confronts you, you're going to turn on them and attack them.
Right.
Okay? It depended on your value system. A lot of people came back and fought that with drugs. A lot of people ended up in the pen, and a lot of people ended up, like myself, holding it in and ended up with PTSD.
Right.
Because ultimately, you don't have, as you get older, you don't have the energy to hold it in. It starts coming out anyway. And you used to, that's how a lot of people would start having, I started by having a nightmare. Okay? And I started by having a job where I could go all the time. I was always happy leaving. But when I got someplace to work in forestry, I felt uneasy. I always wanted to go to some. So you're always trying to run to some place that stress isn't. So for a long time after the war, you saw these hitchhikers on the road. You ask where they come from. Well, there. Where are you going there? They're running from themselves. And I did the same thing in my job. I would go. I just feel great leaving town, going out to work. But 2 or 3 days working someplace, the stress would still be with me. And so I just started running and becoming a workaholic. But what was happening is it was getting worse all the time. I went into my first period of depression about a year after, not even a year, 6 months after I was released from active duty. And I went to Vietnam right then, so I don't, close to a year and three quarters when I got back. And so about, 3 or 4 months after I got out, I went into depression. I didn't even know what it was. It lasted a couple of days and went away. But it got to be longer and longer and longer.
Right.
Until by 1980, it lasted a month, a couple times a year. And what happened was, in 1980, I was married, another family, remarried. I got divorced after I got back. I woke up one night, and I was just in Vietnam. I had a massive nervous breakdown. For 3 years, I didn't even know how I stayed alive. But finally, I went into a treatment center, and I was on medication at work there. What they do is they blast the war out of you. They just keep bringing their stress level up to your back there. And that worked for me. I just literally exploded because I blocked out the war when I found out about Meline, and it came back 15 years later in that treatment center. And that's when that's when the anger came for me. I wasn't angry, and I went into like a rage. And then you've got to go into after treatment. It took years to calm down. And I started writing. I didn't start writing, throwing papers away. Like, I started writing to the people at Meli and asking what's going on. And that's how I started writing and doing like investigative reporting on things I knew about.
Right. Now tell me, can you get into what you did with Meli and that whole, and why you went that direction?
Well, because I was angry. And so I started asking what happened. And they tell me to shut up. I got mad and I started telling them to shut up. And That's just what happened. You know, I'd go into a rage when I read about. First off, I blocked it out. I didn't know where Marlon was until I was out of Marine Corps, and I blocked it out. And so I didn't deal with it until I was 45 years old. I had horrible flashbacks because I had not only had a document, I have a photographic memory. I could run that just like a movie.
Right.
After I got angry, every time I did, I'd get so mad I'd literally see red when the press would write about, especially after. I'm not the only one that told them it happened, but I might be the only one that has it documented. I took out my life four as the intelligence officer, and I saw both destroyed as the intelligence officer. And I'm educated, and this was 20 years later, and there wasn't anyone telling me to shut up. And so I never wrote about Mealy on my own. I always responded to somebody else writing about it. Mm-hmm. At first, trying to find out what happened, then trying to get my documents back, then telling them to shut up, and when they wouldn't, I followed. I consider Mealy a legal action in which all the evidence wasn't getting away. Most Vietnam veterans, and so I contacted local attorneys to get it. Wouldn't do that again. They looked at me like I was some pariah.
And when was this? Is this in the 1980s?
This was about 1992, about 4 or 5 years, because I had written periodically.
Okay.
Finally, I contacted F. Lee Bailey, and he referred me to Callie's attorney. And from 1992 on, when the press told me to shut up, I went and contacted Callie's legal firm. They told me what to do.
Now, what documents did you have, and what were you trying to accomplish?
Well, what I was trying to accomplish is to get the guild off the people. First people, the guild of having been a war criminal is apparently something people can't handle in this country, because they put thousands of people in the psychiatric wards that were involved in Mealy just for the knowledge. And there were four, I think, in the one I went to, two of whom killed themselves.
Simply because they knew about Mealy, they were put in.
They just knew about. Well, they were involved. One was a corpsman who treated some of the survivors.
Mm-hmm.
The other was a Maricol Division officer that happened to be, you know, part of the planning and cover up and everything. So you had thousands of people involved in the hospitals and the planning and the helicopters and everything that all felt responsible, you know, And so all over the United States, you had people with the guilt, this
mm-hmm.
guilt. And when you saw the presentations of the press, these guys were suicidal that they talked to. You know, these were the ones, the thing that became public with Cali. But most of what happened didn't become public, and I don't even know what all happened, except that the two villages Cali was supposed to have destroyed actually weren't. So they went back a second time, and since I have a flight logbook and diary, it was the 8th and 9th of October 68.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time, there wasn't anything left. There was just a blazing hole in the ground, and I saw the intelligence reports. Casualties were about 50% bigger and smaller than the village, and my life form must have 1,500 people in it.
Okay, so you're saying the incident in March didn't
was
happen
small now. Compared to the incident in November, because we used aircraft, napalm, and 500-pound bombs.
The same
villages were completely rebuilt. They were completely rebuilt and populated. The fat patties had just been planted. The intelligence reports gave the casualties, which were more than when Cali was there.
Mm-hmm.
And Mylai 4 was a great big village. It wasn't small.
Right.
And because I never attacked intact villages. My wingman and I had never seen anything like this. So we took a good look at it. And my first run, I got aborted. And so I rolled inverted about 600 feet and looked down into the streets. And it was a big, great big village with little huts, and you can see the gray things, but you couldn't see any people. Oh, it was a pre-planned anti-personnel attack. That was the nature of the ordinance, but you, in the shadows of the evening, you couldn't really see people, and there was something wrong with the mission. I mean, nothing matched. Like we were told we were attacking an A battalion with no ground fire, then they aborted us. on a first mission. You don't ever do that when there's you only do that when there's friendly forces in the area, and the friendly forces were supposed to. But anyway, I remembered the mission because it was just outside our traffic pattern, and I never saw an intact village. But we took it out, and it was first napalm, and the flames, they were so high that my last run, I actually flew through them. They were lapping around the cockpit. Then they totally covered it with delayed fuse bombs, which penetrate bunkers underneath and blast the bunkers apart, carry the fire down.
What was the purpose of this mission?
The purpose of the mission, I presume, is to take the witnesses off the map. I just talked to a guy, the first person I ever know that knew about it. He said they were watching it from the America Division because they could see it from our base.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a cover up.
Okay.
It was the final decision.
So it was an effort to get the people who could prosecute Callie and
get the witnesses gone, apparently. And I'm not too sure it is as it appears. As I say, it is a pre-planned anti-personnel attack.
Right.
And I saw both villages destroyed with this massive fire. But there was something wrong with the mission, too. Why, when we set up so slowly, didn't everybody run out? The way the attack was, it was an attack on people in underground bunkers. We wouldn't have seen them.
Right.
But it was a pre-planned anti-personnel attack. And the reason that it was pre-planned is it was atypical ordnance. You had surface ordnance on the first mission, then subsurface ordnance on the second. You didn't do that. And it wasn't done by anybody in the Army. It was all Air Force. It was two Marines, two Air Force Phantoms, and an air controller from the Air Force. So there was no Army involved. And years later, when General Powell was running for president, I heard people calling in from the America Division saying he was the operations officer that orchestrated it.
Was he?
Huh?
Was he?
Apparently.
However, okay.
The first time they attacked the village, it was an entirely different chain of command than the second time.
Right.
They didn't tell anybody the second time what they were doing. And Colin Powell was a major. Colin Powell was manipulated just like us. There was nothing he could do. No major in that division, a black major, would ever be. My guess is that most of the people were lied to and manipulated to the point they had no real idea what happened. And that the fact that I found out was because, first, I was an intelligence officer, and second, it was already history by the time I knew, so I was able to get maps and aerial photos and things like that. And then I was able to talk to people in PTSD groups
right. That
were involved with me. And there were a lot more people involved the second time than the first.
Now, did you fly one of the missions in the second time?
I led the airstrike on Mile 4.
On the second time around, in the fall?
Yeah, in the fall. I wasn't there in March 16th.
Right, right. Okay.
No, I led the airstrike, and I was the duty officer, so I also knew where it came from. And so what happened is when we attacked Mile 4, we didn't have any pilots. We were on stand-down, so the two duty officers took it.
Right.
And the duty officers, we were in contact with the people who sent us, and it came from the air operations section of the Division G3, the same one Callie did. I did a complete analysis, and everything that happened the first time happened the second, except there was a different chain of command. So when everything happens twice the same way, you got the same person orchestrating. So all you have to do is follow the chain of command up, and where it meets, that's who's responsible. And the Army got them. The press didn't cover it, but the Army got them.
Who was that individual?
General Coster and his assistant were kicked out of the Army in disgrace after being demoted. But that press never covered that. They always covered what happened when Callie was there. But
right.
The actual two people that got it got kicked out. Reduced in rank and kicked out of the Army. Well, it forced into retirement. But everybody who knows anything about the military, they lived the rest of their life in disgrace.
Now, tell me those names again.
General Coster, who was the commanding general when Callie was there.
And how do you spell that last name?
Coster.
Okay.
And his assistant. They were both reduced in rank. He was the head of the Naval Academy, or Military Academy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they got kicked out for their cover-ups, and probably no one person knows the full extent of the cover-ups, but I used to see them in the intelligence reports. The AmeriCal Division intelligence reports did not follow patterns that other people did. Things that, for example, we would fly to an AmeriCal Division mission, okay, and we would report to the division or the air wing, which would report to the division, okay, and then the AmeriCal would report intelligence reports too. Well, I got the intelligence reports from both the AmeriCal and from the division, and I didn't understand why, for example, the Marine report reported one thing and the AmeriCal didn't report it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I recognize now that the reason my lie occurred and the reason other screw-ups occurred that I now know about is it's what General Schwarzkopf said over and over and over when referred to that command. He said they were political. That is one of the most significant things ever said.
Mm-hmm.
They got into their jobs by who they knew, manipulating the system and all what they knew. When they got into a position of command where they had to make a decision, they didn't know what to do, so they screwed up and covered up. That was their whole career, and that happened. My lie is one that came public, but I think it was happening all the time. I know another situation that I talked about with people who were involved where I told you about all those massive forces behind the mountain.
Yes.
AmeriCal Division set a helo lift in there on top of them. They were blown away. They had to bring in the 82nd Airborne to get them out of there. Well, nobody that knew anything and from the intelligence reports would have done that. We hit it with interdicting fire from harassment from the battleship and cruisers and with arc lights, but we never saw any troops in there.
Mm-hmm.
What that was was a rebuilding area for shot out troops. I know a lot of, see, when I dealt with Mili, it was already history. So I could get things most people couldn't. I could talk to people who were involved with me, and I could read books, and I was able to check out the court martial file. And I got maps. I got tactical maps to go with my, gosh, I have the coordinates in my flight log book.
Right.
Bravo Sierra 07. I also got the date and time within 15 minutes. And I was the intelligence officer. I know the casualties, and I talked to other people. And I have unique knowledge. It's just the opposite. I think thousands of people saw it. And based on what I heard on talk radio, each time General Powell's name came up, there must have been 10,000 people knew that happened, because you could see it from the big base at Chulai. You could see it from all the mountains around there. And by then, a lot of Army troops knew about it. I'm not so sure that most people involved didn't know what was happening then and figured it out later, because nobody that I knew in our chain of command knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'd have thought something about it. One thing we did do that indicated that we might know about it to them was we refused a distinguished flying cross for the mission.
Hmm.
We were offered a distinguished flying cross, just like a helicopter pilot was.
You were offered the DFC for that mission?
Yeah. But the Marine Corps had a dual authentication. Not only did the person that wrote the DFC have to authenticate it, the pilots in the Marine Corps had to authenticate it was justified. So that was something different. We couldn't be awarded the DFC until we authenticated it, and the Marine Corps set that up so this sort of thing wouldn't happen.
Right.
And so we refused to authenticate it because the mission didn't justify it. And so we sent it back. Okay. As far as I know, everybody that knew about that mission that was on it in the Marine Corps and the Air Force was dead within a year.
Why weren't you killed?
Well, I kept the diary.
Okay.
Every plane from the 28th of October, 68, until the 15th of February, 69, every single plane I was scheduled to be flying on ended up with fuel problems. Two of them I didn't take. One disappeared, the other crashed. The rest of the time I made emergency landings.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. However, there is another, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Planes don't have fuel problems, but it happened. It was, and they were all fueled in different places. I can't prove anything except the probability of everybody dying suddenly, expectedly, alone in accidents isn't right, except there might be a secondary cause. The stress of being involved is so great, I think it could kill people at the time.
Right.
The people I knew that all died in ways that I would expect under extreme stress, drunken wreck, a heart attack. Two that disappeared don't compute. The only two people I ever know that disappeared in Bronte Light were two involved in that.
How many people total were involved that you know of?
I'm talking about only the people I know.
Okay.
I know. That might not be significant because you can have more than one cause. The stress of being involved in something like this. As I say, I blocked my memory. I'd been in a war. I had everything from the time I found out I was in my line. And a reaction around me, it snapped. It took 15 years. And even when my memory started to come back, it took 10 years to even realize it was real. You know, I mean,
right.
I can't describe to you what it's like to be the real person responsible for the Mylan massacre, because Cali didn't do much, but we did. So when you're talking about the Mylan massacre, most of the people were killed by us. And it had to be that way. And the only way it could not be is if somebody else killed them and we covered it up.
Right.
But I've never run into anybody that said that. I have run into other people. And I also sought an appraisal for my historical file. And I ran into the same exact statement from other people. And they did say that it was populated and they did kill them. And one was a Marine. There was another Marine made a statement, and I was calling, getting appraisals, and an appraiser had appraised his document saying exactly the same thing I said.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on a patrol up on the hill. That's a hill we bombed. After we hit Mile 4, we had surface ordnance. We attacked the hill above the village. Well, we had the hills, not the enemy. And I think they were just dumping our ordnance.
But dumping it on friendlies?
I think the controller was just dumping our ordnance somewhere because we had surface ordnance. And when they brought the two Phantoms in, they used delayed fuse ordnance, which penetrated the bunkers.
Right.
And all we'd have done is blown fire all over ourselves.
Do you think that they offered you the DFC so you would keep quiet?
I just know it's a pattern. They offered the DFC to make him pilot. Everything that happened the first time happened the second time.
Right.
Okay. And it just fit the pattern.
In the last, what kind of contact have you had with people about this in the last few
years? I was offered $1 million for an interview. Connie Chung tried to interview me. It was blocked.
Who blocked it?
I don't know. I'll tell you that things have happened that tell me that they don't receive. When I contacted Callie's attorney, here's the ethics of the press. You cannot sue the press for what they won't write, even if what they do write is no longer true. So they could start writing a story, get more evidence, they don't have to write it. The second one is no one who was released from active duty or discharged was reachable by the Army for the court-martial. And that's because the Army doesn't have the right of the International Tribunal in, where is it, Europe somewhere.
In The Hague.
The Hague, to call people back who are out of the Army. The Army can't do that. Third one is the most important. After World War II, not everyone tried as a war criminal was tried at the Nuremberg trials. That some were tried by the United States Army, and they were given the right of appeal before the Supreme Court. And one general did so, setting the precedent for Cali to do so. And so I was asked to contact him and tell him about and I sent a letter to him, and I always sent more than one letter to document it, and I have a file. He didn't reply, but I'm not sure my letter has ever got through to him, because The one thing is if we bring the, if you brought the mean line thing up, if you bring a whole lot more up,
yes, sir,
than what happened at mean line, because when I did my research, the first thing I looked at was not what Hirsch wrote or books. I looked at the Federal Register.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at what Congress said, and what Congress said was that there were five villages. That was right in the Federal Register, and so really, what I think is if they would have expanded the area of search, they'd have found more villages until they'd have been all over Vietnam and they'd have found hundreds of them. And the reason is the enemy used their own people as shields.
Right.
And so having to attack a village, I mean, I've seen guys break down and cry. I saw a guy who was saying he's in a tank and they're shooting flechette, which is like shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
And here come all the villagers out, women and children, and behind them the enemy, and he's got to level the villagers first. Well, that was alien to our thinking, but that's what the enemy did.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up in their own villages, and we attacked them. And so they used their own people as shields.
Mm-hmm.
And it even happened to me. It wasn't innocence, but I only took one prisoner ever. I was a company commander for 3 months. And I was at Da Nang, and what happened is during the Tet Offensive, we were hit in the south by a sapper company, which they were companies of 15 people with a company commander. And anyway, they came in, and they hit right in front of a reinforced rifle company, and they blew up the, they blew 15 people, they tripped the flare, and they blew 15 people just to pieces. But turned out these 15 people were young women, about 15, 16 years old. Our troops just sort of went. But we captured the platoon commander alive, and he snapped. I mean, he was a bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, that tells me that when you got women in combat, it isn't just us that were affected. Their own man from their village went nuts too. That's something nice about women in combat. When I had a company, there were three things that you could not have, that you simply could not have in your unit that broke up unity of command. I'm talking about a real tough unit. We didn't have a real tough defense area, but I had a real tough unit.
Mm-hmm.
There were three things that always broke it up. One was a thief in the barracks. Another was a homosexual, known homosexual, active homosexual. The other was a woman. And those three things broke up unity of purpose. And there were other things. But those things did it every single time. And you didn't have to have the whole company react. You only had to have three or four people. And it started breaking things down. And so when I was a company commander, I learned a lot about human relationships of dealing with men, because I had no other officers. I took over 3 days before the 69th Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to do a whole lot by myself. And I learned a lot. As I say, I was a trained infantry officer. I learned a whole lot of human relationships there. And the one thing that I learned is that when you're in combat, it isn't rank that controls it, and it's training to a degree, but the one thing you got to have is unity of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have everybody working together. And if you have anything that breaks that apart, you lose unity of purpose, you lose the effectiveness of your unit, and you lose the effectiveness of yourself as a commander for allowing it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I maintain unity of purpose by basically, these men were experienced. I didn't have to tell them what they had to do. I had to prepare a lifestyle and a situation for them where they were armed. They were armed, fed well, got their supplies, everything was done, and they would act themselves. All I had to do was to give them what they needed. And I had good sergeants. I, I had to use sergeants rather than platoon commanders for platoon commanders because I had no other lieutenants. The only lieutenant I had to be cashiered and court-martialed, so I ended up alone. But these sergeants were all combat vets, and so our unit work was real good. During the Tet Offensive, in any trouble at all, everything that happened, they did the right thing. And the one thing that I had real trouble with was blacks against blacks. I had black Marines who were sergeants and corporals who were making a Marine Corps career. And then I had black Marines who were enlisted or whatever. Those two pitted each other. They pitted against each other. They called the guys who were really trying, Uncle Toms and Ori, they'd come talk to me, you know. Mm-hmm. What am I supposed to do? And I can understand that. And I said, so you've got to live your life. They're trying to drag you down. And they said, you don't want to be drugged down to them. And that's what they're trying to do. And I only ever had one sergeant. And our method of dealing with problems was to transfer him to a combat unit. And because we were a combat unit too, but we were a defensive combat unit, and I transferred, and that seemed to work. But I had to handle the personal problems of the blacks, and right then I couldn't even comprehend the problem, much less solve them.
Right.
Their family relationships broke down. People disappeared. Their wives were married to two people. One guy was getting pornographic movies from families. There was deaths and stuff, and I couldn't send anybody home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my worst Marines in that company were black. My worst Marines were white, and I don't know where they came from, but they were just here and there. My best Marines were my black sergeants. As I say, they were in lieutenant's positions. I had them all in key positions. And I had internal security, and that was bad news. We had a lot of people go nuts, and then we had people deserting. And see, that was the transit facility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we had people coming through there and going out.
Was this at Da Nang?
Da Nang, right. And so I started accumulating things that people left country. Because they were going out on emergency leave and things, and so I started getting weapons. Then there would be shipments come in for the Army and no Army to take them, so I ended up with a bomb dump. And I started accumulating all this stuff from people. You know, people had nobody to pick it up, so I had a bomb dump full of Jeeps, and I had a tank, a big Army tank, and a lot of weapons. I mean, I had, my unit was had M14s on M16s, but I had enough M16s to equip them. Those were all Army weapons, and a lot of them were lost. And then I had to deal with the legal system. I had to do a lot of investigations. I had to do investigations under violations of international law. That was when pilots were killed on the ground, you know, by the enemy. Or we had one violation of international law in our own squadron, where a pilot was shot down in North Vietnam carrying a doctor on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, when I was a company commander, I wasn't fighting. I was trying to keep people equipped to deal with the legal system. And when I left Vietnam, I don't know how many pieces of evidence I had to lock up, because you have to see, when you're a lieutenant or captain, you're a lawyer in the military. So I was doing investigations, sitting in courts martials, acting as a defense counsel, and investigations, a lot of times there would be evidence, pistols
mm-hmm.
and rifles and Jeeps and things that had to be maintained as chain of evidence.
Right.
So that it could be used in a court martial, and since I had a bomb dump and since I had an armory, I was signed for all this stuff, and that was, you know, something that was constantly going on. That followed me back to the United States. It followed me into the reserves. Follow ups on those investigations. followed me to the day I resigned from reserve.
What day did you come back from Vietnam?
I came back at the end of April in 1969.
Okay, and you stayed in active until when?
I got out in August of 1970, and I went overseas again.
Mm-hmm.
I got transferred to the 2nd Anglico, which is an air naval gunfire company attached to an artillery battalion that goes with allies.
Mm-hmm.
And I first in air control and a commanding officer. We were the fleet, and I went with the Atlantic Fleet down to Villegas.
Mm-hmm.
And usually those things, they're shoots or something. There's some sort of a show of force or something going on. And I ended up out on an island training my controllers. I had to give an air show for the commandant, a combined air, naval gunfire, and artillery. And that's mm-hmm. something you don't do. We had a whole radar system in Vietnam set up so that didn't happen.
Right.
But I then got out of the Marine Corps and stayed in reserve for a couple of years.
So
in reserve.
You reserved from what, 70 to 72?
Yeah, I got out when I found out about MeLai. That was it. I got out.
Right.
But I kept a diary in Vietnam. That diary's in my historical file. And you know what in that diary is significant?
What's that?
The worst things I write have shown no emotion. There is no emotion in that diary whatsoever. Anything what you eat is described the same as the worst situations I ever was when people were shot down and they were killed.
Right.
They would talk to you on the radio as they're getting killed, call in artillery on themselves. The other thing is, did you remember the movie Platoon?
Yes.
What was the last scene in Platoon? They called an airstrike in.
Yes.
You ever wonder what a pilot thinks when they say hit the white smoke and all radios go dead?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, we didn't know they did that. All we know, a bunch of friendlies got killed. And they did. They did call in airstrikes on themselves because it was better to do that than to get captured. They didn't capture people, really. But so we were left with a lot of questions. And a lot of the questions that other people had were answered for me by the intelligence report.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no way to communicate that to anybody but my commanding officer, who told me what I couldn't do.
What made you change your mind and come out with all of this and start writing letters and start talking about it?
Well, I blocked the war out. And then I lost my job and went to the treatment center, and I watch people go up. See, what the people, a lot of people there, they put people together alike. Everybody there was like me, well-employed and everything, and had done well. And all of a sudden, we're all divorced. We can't remember the war. What they do is they get you angry
mm-hmm.
so that you'll deal with the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then they teach you ways to deal with the anger. And one way they teach you to do it is to write,
mm-hmm.
to write down what you think. And I do. I write it down quite often. I throw it away. It's an expenditure of energy. The first time I wrote about MeLai, it was a huge release, but it didn't stay.
Okay.
And the reason it didn't stay wasn't because of me. It was because of what kept showing up in the press. Once I saw it in the press, it all came back. And so I started responding to the press, telling them to shut up. It took about 4 letters, and then the anger would go away. But I never got over the flashbacks of MeLai. One reason I think it is MeLai was a war crime. We grew up in the aftermath of World War II.
Right.
Where war criminals were the Nazis and the Jews and things like that. I don't think you can tell an American soldier and call him a war criminal and put the guilt of the world on him. I think it'll destroy him, because everybody I knew involved in MeLai is just like me. When Colin Powell ran for president, I heard so many people call in trying to turn him in that I could not believe it. And when we get in PTSD groups, the people from MeLai are as irrational today. I just simply don't think you can call an American a war criminal, and I think the same thing's going to happen to those people in Iraq that are treated that way. You can't turn the world opinion this and make us a... somebody that ran a death camp was. I mean, it took me 10 years from the time I remembered my life
mm-hmm.
until I realized it really happened. I mean, I could remember it, but it took me 10 years before. And this, we're talking 1997.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and then I had the battle with the press.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling me to shut up. And I'm right for the press on the West Coast. I just appealed the Northwest Forest Plan to the Supreme Court 2 years ago. I'm just as much as an investigative reporter they were. So
mm-hmm.
they're telling me to shut up and everything when I'm writing for the press on the West Coast that says, if I deviate from fact or cover anything up, I'm never going to be seen in print again. And I'm getting from Seymour Hersh, I'm getting this shut up. They wouldn't give my documents back. So the major press can do whatever they want, and I didn't. So
mm-hmm.
at the same time, I was writing about Medline and ultimately sent the legal precedents to the criminal division of the Army about the No-Gun Rye court-martial from 2000, Korea.
Mm-hmm.
That disappeared 3 or 4 days after I sent them, because that came from Callie's attorney.
Okay.
I was writing on the West Coast perfectly rationally about the Northwest Forest Plan, and I kept getting higher and higher until I was dealing with the president of both issues. Ultimately, see, I filed an ethics violation against Seymour Hersh, because for the same thing that I was told to, covering things up, and the press wouldn't do anything, so President Clinton did. He enforced it. But it didn't do any good. He just brought this thing up about Iraq. And he wrote a real spurious book about President Kennedy, remember?
Yes, I do.
Let
me ask you, do you think Seymour Hersh wanted to cover up what you knew and what others knew about the second My Lai?
He did cover it up. He told me to be quiet.
He knew about it, and so he wanted to basically, since he was the one who broke that story, he wanted to keep that.
I don't think I broke the story to him. I think he knew about it from the first, and I don't think he brought it up, and I wonder why. I'll tell you one thing. I had it documented. I could prove it. Other people couldn't. I don't know why. What I told him was, you better watch out. There's a lot of people involved in Milan. I said, somebody's going to come into a position of power that got directly involved, and that's happened. President Bush is in an awkward situation now. I appealed the Northwest Forest Plan to the Supreme Court, and he backed me, and so did the Interior Department.
Mm-hmm.
So he's dealing with me, the person that led the ICE strike, killed the people. At the same time, he's Secretary of State, appears to be the one that orchestrated the attack. That's what happens when the press doesn't focus the guilt at the right level. The guilt's still on us. The two generals manipulated both of us, and I knew that. I was an officer, intelligence officer. I knew we were all manipulated, but the enlisted men calling the radio didn't.
Right.
So I trust one editor, and that's Mortimer Zuckerman. I'm the one that went to U.S. News and World Report and sent them my analysis. There's no way a black major in an Army division I knew could have any effect on anything. Any effect on anything. Says we were all lied to and manipulated. And he says he couldn't do one thing. If he'd have tried to do something, he'd have been cutting up ice cubes in the Arctic or worse.
So Powell did or did not orchestrate the attack?
I don't know. He was the operations officer at a certain time. But what I'm getting at, I've never met anybody, including people from the Army that were involved,
mm-hmm.
that knew what they were doing at the time.
Okay.
There was an entirely different chain of command from the top to the bottom.
Right.
I found out from the press. Other people found out from the press. Other people found out from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Colin Powell may not even know. But other people know. And people's never forgotten. All you had to do was watch the TV specials of the people involved in My Lai. Those people were just as affected as everybody. They broke down and cried. Some were suicidal, living in poverty, all on disability. That comes from the guilt. That comes from the guilt. You have your own guilt. That's almost intolerable. You can't take the guilt of the world. I just don't think you can.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying this because I went instantly from one to the other. I didn't give a damn about my life. I didn't care anything about it. I was a civilian. And in 30 seconds, I blocked it out after I found the coordinates in my flight logbook, because I remembered what happened.
Right.
So I went from not caring to being hit like something killed me instantaneously. And so I think that happened to other people, and I know it happened to other people. Because I've talked to them.
Where do you think it'll go from here?
I mean, nothing will happen to me, what will happen is files like mine will also be examined, and sure, there's too many people that know, and my file only has a little bit about me. I have a flight logbook and a diary that goes to the flight logbook, so it's possible to track the missions and know what happened, and then I wrote a book about the things like that and poetry,
mm-hmm.
and so it's possible through, and I had pictures, I sent some pictures up. I took pictures of our living area and things, not much from the air. I did take a picture that showing Mili in relationship to Chulai, did have one there, so I left a historical file in Walla Walla that covers pretty much everything we've talked now about. Oh, it doesn't have the emotions. And I'd say that the training I had as an infantry officer gave me a different perspective than the training the pilots had who didn't go through that infantry training. Because of the fact I knew what was going on the ground more, and then I was on the ground, where it's funny, I read books by generals, and they didn't have the overview. General Schwarzkopf, who was stationed the same place I was flying, simply didn't have the overview of facts I did, because I was flying all over Vietnam, and I was reading the intelligence reports for the whole American division, and they tended, I'll tell you what happened, things started repeating themselves over and over and over. So you were following the same patterns all the time, and one reason the Mili thing stuck out is it didn't follow a pattern. It broke the pattern.
Right.
Yeah. And anything that broke the pattern, you remember, because day after day you flew the same places and back, and other things broke the pattern.
Right.
But things that broke the pattern, it's like in your day-to-day work, you drive by the same house, and one day it's gone. Okay,
right.
That stands out. And that's sort of the way the war was. I never found the long hours of boredom interspersed by periods of stark care to be true. I found that I was on edge from the time I got there and exhausted till the time I left, maybe 6 months after.
Let me ask you this. Do you think the United States learned any lessons from its experience in Vietnam?
I think they learned a lot of lessons, but I think we tend to repeat our mistakes over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole military changed because of Vietnam. One thing that we did learn, and I don't know that we learned in Iraq, we violated the principles of Karl von Clausewitz,
mm-hmm.
and the 9 principles of war. We had a political objective, but we had no military objective. And that is what the people who were protesting the war said. We weren't doing anything. We weren't. You know what the objective ultimately became was the body count.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't use hills that we took, because we take them and give them up and take them again. That's what really struck me, is we kept fighting over the same ground all the time, and all we were doing was going after the enemy, and then we'd leave, we'd run a sweep, and the enemy coming in, and from the air you could see something you couldn't see from the ground. Almost everywhere we had troops, ground fire came from all around them. It was not like we swept into Europe. It was like a boat in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And the enemy was all around them almost everywhere. I don't know exactly what we were doing, and I've just heard on the radio that General Giap said after the war, after the Tet Offensive, we won the war, but that's not what it looked like to me.
Mm-hmm.
It looked to me like we were predictable in our actions, and they could then act on their initiative against us. And it looked to me like, and I did have the history before I went there. It looked to me like the best we could do is knock them down for a while and they'd just come back up again.
Mm-hmm.
Like if we'd have gone home and we'd have won, what would we have won? We'd have won a peace for 10, 20, 30 years now, just would have started over again.
Right.
You've probably heard the history of Vietnam, the 2,000-year China fight against the Chinese, and the And then they had the gold. What Vietnam was trying to get back was the gold age of Vietnam, when Hue was a college and everything. That's what they were trying to get back to, unified and everything. But I'm not sure if they were unified in that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask one question to you. You must have talked to a lot of people involved in the My Lai thing over time. What's your observation?
Well, actually, I haven't interviewed anybody from the My Lai incident at all.
Oh, you haven't?
No, I have not. But I am going in a few weeks to the AmeriCal Division Association reunion, and I might have the opportunity at that point to meet some of the people involved.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Yes, sir. Let me ask you this. Have you ever been to the wall in Washington?
I drove by it, but no, I didn't. I did go to a reunion of my infantry people. I went to a reunion of the A4 pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, I couldn't believe the difference. The ground forces. And they're formal. We had formal meetings, went to 8th and I dressed up.
Mm-hmm.
Just exactly like the Marine Corps. The pilots showed up, and the pilots were all really smart. They were had to be like A-minus students to be. These guys showed up in leathers on motorcycles and were farmers, and it's like they got it out of their system, went and did what they want. We had four foresters there, and FBI agents and farmers, and the pilots, they weren't anything like the ground Marines. There was none of this. See, when we had the reunion of the ground Marines, we talked about the medals we had and signed the Marine Corps. I don't remember talking about the Marine Corps at all at the Marine Corps A4 pilots reunion.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about flying and the places we went. And it was a different thing.
Was it a good experience for you?
Yeah, both were. And I wrote a poem. I wrote a long poem for the one reunion, and then at the pilots reunion, I got together with a lot of people I'd flown combat with.
Right.
You know, after years and years. And it's funny. Remember you mentioned about relationships?
Yes, sir.
You pick up right where you left off.
Really?
Yeah, it was like yesterday I talked to them. Today I picked up conversations that were left off. One thing I did get to do, I did get to talk to a friend who wrote to I did an MIA investigation. It was a violation of the Geneva Convention. And that was part of the My Lai thing, too. He knew about My Lai, and I was supposed to be flying that plane. And that plane took off and disappeared in broad daylight. And planes didn't disappear in broad daylight. And I got the investigation. The investigation didn't make any sense. I did the investigation, and nothing fit. Nothing fit at all. Planes just didn't check out of North Vietnam and just disappear off the face of the earth.
Right.
And he had maintained contact with that guy's wife.
Okay.
And, well, something happened after that. Congressional investigations started following me, and they followed me for years, and they were never shown to me. And I'm wondering, he is one person I know for sure that would have known about the My Lai thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he wrote to his wife. And his name was Colonel Major Connors. And he lived in Nashville, but there must be 275 Connors in Nashville, so I never could get hold of his family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if I ever, I don't think I've ever contacted anybody. Oh, wait. Remember when when they had that thing in Washington, D.C., where people could call and ask about on the wall? I got about six calls on that. Those people didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was the intelligence officer, I knew in all of them. And And so they weren't ever told. And I could give the details of what happened. It really, it was, all but one, it was a relief. But the other one, they claimed this person was still alive and everything. And you know, they were part of this thing that says they're all prisoners still there and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for damn sure he isn't alive because he was drunk and flew into Target. And I did the search, and nobody in that area was ever captured. But I did talk to six people who called me,
mm-hmm.
and all of them were happy because they found out the only thing they ever knew. And the one person I wanted to get called was for Roy Schmidt, and I never got called by his family. And that was a bad one. That was, we lost not only the plane went down, but both Jolly Greens got shot down. And just a few months ago, one of them was found and had a Coast Guard pilot in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote to the Coast Guard when I was there when that happened.
Mm.
That sort of thing didn't bother me at the time, and I never forgot it. When you got a pilot down and both Jolly Greens get shot down, you got 10 people on the ground. And,
yes. Well, Mr. Lathrop, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversations of the past 2 days?
No, I think I've covered it pretty much. Is there anything you'd want to know?
No, sir. If there is, I'll definitely contact you.
Okay, well, I do have a historical file with a lot of stuff in it.
Yes, sir.
And they put it there. I put it there because of the press tried to steal it. And the curator was my cousin. So I have everything there, and I have the analysis of the Mealy thing and stuff like that.
And where's it located again?
Whitman College, Penrose Library.
Okay.
Whitman College.
Okay.
All Walla right. Walla, Washington.
Okay. Well, very good. Sir, let me do a quick sign off of the interview. This will now end our oral history interview with Mr. Robert Lathrop. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.